people might think that my Munster hat is too Munster. Got to get into a position where we're rewarding form as opposed to credit in the bank.
The Red 78 with Alan Quinlan and Niamh Briggs. Subscribe to the Rugby Channel on the OTB Sports app and turn on your notifications now.
OTB AM with Gillette, proud supporters of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow.
It's 7:30 on this Wednesday morning. You're welcome along to OTB AM. Owen, Kenny and Nathan with you right the way through until 10 o'clock this morning. And we're also going to be joined by Andy Mitten and Caoimhe O'Neill throughout the morning. So it is Champions League, as you can imagine, most of the way. But we'll also be talking about Damien Duff's first foray into his main managerial role. And we'll also be going through Ireland's depth chart, Republic of Ireland's depth chart in the defender section. So we'll get Kenny and Nathan's take on that a little bit later on. We'd love to hear your views as well this morning. You can tweet us at Off The Ball or comment on the YouTube stream this morning. We're going to go straight to the coming up graphic this morning just to let you know what's coming up over the course of the next couple of hours. As I say, it's going to be Champions League most of the way this morning, but we'll also be touching on Antonio Conte to Tottenham and whether or not Unai Emery is going to go to Newcastle. Some suggestion this morning that that deal may not happen at this point. Andy Mitten will be with us at 8:15. He was in Bergamo last night, and the sports page is coming your way at 8:30 before the sports news at 8:40. And then Caoimhe O'Neill will be setting the scene for Liverpool's clash with Atletico Madrid tonight. The Republic of Ireland depth chart at 9:05 and Damien Delaney from 9:30. So a packed morning of football coming your way. Kenny Cunningham, you're very welcome.
Morning, lads.
Nathan Murphy back from holiday. How are you getting on?
Morning, everybody.
So, Kenny, everything is right in the world.
Sorry, I thought you were going to persevere.
Oh, well, we can do if we want.
That was interesting.
Poor
journalism on my part, Kenny.
Not a huge amount to say.
Any trips?
If you're anywhere but the World Atlantic Way, I'll be.
Well, I was. I spent the weekend over in Galway, Kenny. A beautiful, rainy Saturday night in Galway, out in the
Galway
beer,
town.
Galway town,
in,
yeah.
In the city. Mixer.
They like to see it as a city still down in down the west, Kenny. Yeah, down Dominic Street. Great spot, don't you? And not well at this stage.
I've been down there. I was down there the last couple of months. I had an overnight stay down there in Galway. Poof, that is a good town.
Where'd you go, Kenny?
No, I just had a ramble. I haven't been down there for a long time, but just had a ramble around the Spanish Arch.
Spanish Arch.
But great, good buzz, nice restaurants, pubs.
Ah, Galway's just like a transformed city over the last 6-7 years. I went to college in Galway and worked in Galway, left in about 2006, and it was like obviously a great drinking city when you were in college and that. Now you go back, you go down Dominic Street from the top and then you are down to Roisin Dhubh and all the way down to Kye down the end. It's just bars, restaurants, as good as you get anywhere, Kenny.
Yeah, but it's not too messy. It looks like something for everybody. A lot of young kids there, fair enough. Obviously, the college scene there, like you said. But like I said, some nice restaurants, some older people there as well. You know, quite sophisticated. Bit of you written all over it, Owen.
Wasn't that sophisticated about 2 o'clock on Saturday night, I can tell you, Kenny.
I'll accompany you, Arkevin.
I haven't heard this love for Galway coming out of your map before, Kenny. Where does it rank in terms of your favourite places in Ireland?
I'm just saying, just dip me toe. It's just my initial impressions, just having a little ramble around. I'd have to. Because a lot of Dublin people heading down there the weekend or a couple of hours on the train, well within striking distance.
Absolutely.
I can understand it.
Wild Atlantic Way.
This could be a new buddy cop sort of show. Nathan Murphy and Kenny Cunningham on the road doing the Wild Atlantic Way. The new Micah Richards.
Kenny doesn't seem that keen.
What is the equivalent of Mayo? Is that a little bit of, you know, hopping over the border into Galway and talking up Galway, Nathan? Would that be Mayo man like yourself?
If it's a rivalry that's put up there, obviously I'm going to do down Galway, but you know, we.
So where would you talk up in Mayo for a night out? We're good, you know.
But back in the day, Kenny, Midas Nightclub Ballyhonus would have been the place to go. Could have done you a deal, could have got you in the back door for free. Probably
would
have been
a big
star. Everything you touch turns to gold.
But the N17 in Kilchamah, the N17, when you were a young lad, the N17 in Kilchamah was definitely the place. You know, you got people from all over Mayo. You know,
we're not 17 now, Nate.
Wild
as a
Belmont.
You want to go to Westport?
Westport. Have you been to Westport lately?
No.
Ah, get yourself down to Westport.
That's episode 2 of Nathan and Kenny's Wild Atlantic Way Tour, isn't it?
You could do Crowpatrick, you know, get the bit of exercise as well.
Fitbit, get me Fitbit on.
Exactly. Nice restaurants, great nightlife, Kenny.
Good food, it's got to be good food, Nathan. That's a given.
An even better welcome in Westport than you'll get in Galway.
There's that rivalry thing coming out. That's what I was saying. Kilbane Homestead
out in Ackle.
It's true.
Yeah. Kilbane statue as you go over the bridge at Ackle Sound.
Is there anything there? Is there anything over there?
For Kevin, or in general?
Kilbane in particular. Like, is there anything?
You think they should have a statue?
Well, I thought
he's got over 100 Irish caps. Is that not good enough for a statue?
Yeah, one of their favourite sons. No, yeah.
I would say anybody with over 75
caps.
Drum?
Are we beating the drum
here?
Start
now. Absolutely, absolutely.
I mean, like, and
all in on it.
I would say that anybody over 75 caps can each get a statue. And I mean, are we going to get a statue outside St. Vincent's for Kay Cunningham at some point?
No. I'm well down the pecking order there, St. Vincent's.
Okay, well, that's...
Hold my hand up to that.
I beg to differ. I think that there should be something.
We did a show down in Ackle Sound about 2 years ago, just pre-COVID. Caban came back. We did it in the clubhouse in Ackle GA Club. And they were queuing round the block for about 2 hours beforehand to see Caban.
I bet Kev got emotional, Nathan, didn't he? I bet he got emotional.
He did.
He's that type.
Yeah.
Soft.
My people.
Here
soft,
for me.
Soft scent that Kev.
Yeah, I mean, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, Kenny. we were chatting before coming on air that you actually did watch Manchester United last night. You weren't too bogged down in following the events at COP26 as you've been telling us before we came on air. But Manchester United caught your interest last night. Are they back? Is everything normal? Everything okay?
That depends what constitutes normal at Old Trafford these days. Yeah, I suppose it was kind of classic cliche, kind of get out of jail time again. Felt a little bit like that. Performance was very scratchy, I thought, from the first minute to the last. And wouldn't say they didn't deserve the equaliser. Wasn't much in the game, to be honest with you. They were a little bit loose as well, Atlanta. I've been a little bit disappointed with them over the two games, to be honest with you. I've seen a lot of them play the last few years under Gasperini and haven't really been at it. I mean, they've been without some key players as well, should be noted, over the two games, defenders in particular. So it was a good time for United to get hold of them. But rather look a little bit last night, United. But now look about the quality of the Manchester United goals. I'd say that great strike for the second goal, Ronaldo. But the first goal was a brilliant team goal, actually. Fernandes, Bruno, Ronaldo, and even
Greenwood,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, some wonderful one-touch play there. So, yeah, I don't know what the word is. A bit pained at the moment, Manchester United supporters, I'd imagine. You know, you should be getting excited in terms of some of the quality which they're producing in higher areas up the pitch, and Ronaldo in particular scoring some spectacular goals. But you can turn a blind eye to what's happening a little bit further down the pitch, which is nothing new, really.
What phenomenal, isn't it, what Ronaldo's doing? The quality of the second goal, the finish. Like, when everyone else switches off, seems to be when he is most on. You think back to the game against Ireland, the two goals in injury time. Like, his energy level seemed to rise in the last couple of minutes. Suddenly he's making these little movements constantly. And the way he was able to adjust his body, the second he saw it flicking up for Greenwood, you could see him turning his body and preparing himself for the volley. Like, to be able to do that at the end of a tough bloody 90 minutes for Manchester United. I know he doesn't massively exert himself, but the finishing quality is still as good as ever from Ronaldo, if not better.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I think before he signed, I think it was probably commonly agreed, or I would imagine, that he's probably the best all-round finisher in the world for the reasons that you're saying. Left foot, right foot, and kind of headed ability. I don't see anybody better. And you're right, you mentioned the point there yourself, Nathan, when, minute left and... no kind of physical, mental fatigue. I suppose this is going to be the ongoing argument with him, in terms of conserving his energy for these moments in the game where he can, these moments come, and that mental focus is there, and physically he can kind of get his body into those positions or whatever. Don't necessarily think he's outrunning people in the last minutes of the games, and he's got more energy than people. It's just those... just those concentration levels, and I think game understanding as well, Nathan, just in terms of those moments where he needs to be, and even kind of anticipation, where the ball might arrive, and finding a little bit of space for himself. And you're right, that little bit of a body adjustment last night, I actually thought it was a great touch from Greenwood.
Mm.
I didn't get enough credit. He didn't have anywhere to go there, Greenwood, that ball popped up. But I think he knew his peripheral vision, he knew the area of the pitch where Ronaldo was, and he just kind of helped it into that area, almost hoping that Ronaldo would come onto the ball, which he did. Like, it was a brilliant strike. So yeah, but no, that story's gonna run and run, because there's no quick fix to the issues that they have. There is no quick fix, there's no fix at all for the issues which they have, particularly in that kind of central midfield area. And one or two players, Harry Maguire I'd say in particular, really kind of drop off in form for one or two players as well. Even the fullbacks, to be fair, I was actually talking up start of the season, Luke Shaw and Wan-Bissaka, in terms of their defensive qualities. Now, I would argue them too, in terms of their defensive qualities as good as anybody in the league. Wan-Bissaka, we know the efficiencies he has in possession and in the opposition half, a 1v1, he's as good as anybody. Luke Shaw was the best, probably the best left back in the league last year, defended extremely well. They've been a little bit off at this season, so there's a lot of stuff going on there at the moment around Manchester United. So yeah, that's not going to resolve itself soon.
And there's loads of things we can get into there. Just to go back to Ronaldo for a moment, he was obviously open to a lot of criticism in the aftermath of the Liverpool game, and naturally the Manchester United fans' tendency last night is to go full defensive in defense of Cristiano Ronaldo. Like, you even looked through Rio Ferdinand's tweets, crying laughing emojis, as you'd imagine. He's apparently the problem, with a Pinocchio emoji, and then he was on BT Sport, you know, saying he doesn't work hard enough, he doesn't close people down, he doesn't press, with a yawn emoji after he tweeted it out last night. So that's the tone from the Manchester United faithful after last night. But can these two things be true, where you can criticise Cristiano Ronaldo if Solskjaer wants to play a pressing game and how ineffective he is in that, and also praise how incredible he is, how he is literally, well, possibly the best finisher in the world right now?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, to be honest with you. I mean, if that's what Ferdinand's putting up there, I think it's pretty weak, to be honest with you. Somebody with his kind of game understanding, Ferdinand can recognise. We've all played with those type of players who, you know, they're going to be limited in terms of maybe the amount, the energy they can expend out of possession of the football, but they merit inclusion in the team because of the qualities which they bring to the team when you're in possession. And Ronaldo's probably a good example of that. So you're absolutely right. It's not that one argument's right and the other one's wrong. The truth is somewhere there in the middle. And you saw that in how he shaped up the team against Tottenham, I think, last week. He went back to the back 3-5, played with a narrow three in midfield, Bruno off the right, Fred and McTominay, but obviously paired Cavani up with Ronaldo, so that now he had like a partner alongside to share the load a little bit, and somebody who could, a runner as well. Even at Cavani's age, you know, he's prepared to run down the sides, can actually stretch teams down the sides. So even that small modification for me from Solskjaer made sense. I thought, well that's good. He's getting the extra defender in there. Spoke about Maguire at the moment, lack of confidence, a little bit, needing a bit of protection. The back five with Varane in there certainly gave him that against Spurs. Got somewhat of a still not sure of that. You can divvy up that midfield area whichever way you wanted, with two or the three, but while you got Fred and McTominay in there, for me there's always going to be deficiencies there. There's no quick fix there, that's a given, so park that one. But at least up front, getting Ronaldo into a pair them with Cavani and getting legs around and somebody in contact with him higher up the pitch, because when Bruno plays as a 10 off Ronaldo, great when he stays within 10-15 yards of Ronaldo, and you can see the benefit when they play close together. The ball from Bruno to Ronaldo for the goal at Spurs was a great example. There was a great ball from Fernandes, I don't know if you remember, Nathan, the young boys game, outside of the right foot. So when those two get in contact in sync, good things can happen. But Bruno can drift and come deep into midfield there. If that distance gets big, Ronaldo can get a little bit kind of detached. So playing the two up front and a natural pair and Cavani, I thought, worked quite well. But they weren't pressing high all the time, were they, them two? They were kind of dropping deep into that kind of lower defensive block, which I think you can do with that kind of back five. You can drop into a lower defensive block and maybe look to play counter-attack a little bit more. So that was interesting what they did against Spurs. And then he flipped it again a little bit last night, went to a narrow three up front last night, Bruno off the right, Rashford.
That didn't work, did it?
Not so much for me. Bruno looked a little bit uncomfortable, that kind of right side of a three, plus out possession, you've got to really drop back in and kind of double up with your wing back almost down that side. So I don't think the balance was as good last night. But then he got Rashford into the team operating off the left, and his pace to kind of run in behind as well. So these are the things he's going to wrestle with, I think, Solskjaer, between now and the end of the season. I think that back five, lads, is here to stay, certainly for the immediate future anyway.
What about Pogba's role with that back five? Because it feels as though it's so well suited when we look at what France do, and they play with the three centre backs, and we think back to the Nations League final and how effective Pogba could be in a midfield too when he had three centre backs behind him. But you watch him last night again, and just so lackadaisical on the ball. So many times during the match, he has it even midway inside the opposition half, and you think, if he loses here, United are in massive trouble, and he does lose it. And even the fight that seems to be there when he's playing for France doesn't seem to be there for United. It does seem to be an attitude thing as much as anything else, because that game last night should have been set up for Paul Pogba, rested from the weekend because he was suspended and taken off after an hour, having made no impact on the game at all.
Yeah, you're right. When he's not influenced the game in possession, as he didn't do enough of last night, it's difficult to make an argument for his inclusion in the team. I don't see a spot for him in the team while they play with that kind of back three. I think Pop, for me, has always got to be protected. You got to play him in the central area of the pitch. I don't play him in the two as United did last night. For me, he plays a little bit hard. He plays as a left sided eight and a three. But you've got to protect him down the sides. You can't ask him to spring out from that central position into wide areas to defend. You can't ask him to make continual 15, 20 yard runs out of possession, covering space, tracking people. It does look, at this stage of his career, doesn't look to me as if he has the engine to do that. You've almost got to protect him and just get the ball to him as often as possible. We know the qualities that he has in possession. Didn't show them last night, Nathan. I agree with you there. The reasons for that, I'm not too sure. My good feeling was, at the end of last season, I felt he needed to sign. United needed to get a firm commitment to him in terms of a new contract in the summer. A 3 or 4 year deal, commit to it, focus, this is your future, knuckle down, or get him out the door. You know, get your 50 million for him, which I think they could have done early in the summer. They've let it linger, he hasn't signed, and it looks to me as if it's just coming to its natural conclusion. He's not going to sign. His agent's probably in there telling him, look, there's fortunes to be made here for us on a free transfer. So
other players in the dressing room care about that? Does that have a... I know John Giles will come on the Thursday night. Help. That has a negative effect on the,
yeah,
on the group.
Depends on the player. Some players are like, can be very focused, will seize an opportunity. Right, I'm moving into summer, but I'm going to prove, I'm going to get myself the best possible move. I'm going to show me best between now and the end of the season. Others, it'll be a little bit different. They'll lose a little bit of focus, a little bit of uncertainty there in their heads. And if that's the case with Pop, if that's what we're seeing now, and he's looking a little bit further down the road in terms of his next move, and potentially what's going to happen in January and beyond that, well, then he's no good. As long as he doesn't kind of down tools in terms of his attitude around the place and on the training pitch, I don't think there'll be a huge amount of the dressing room that'll turn against him. But he's no good. I mean, Paul Pogba got a 70-75% sauntering around the pitch. He's no good to Manchester United, particularly in terms of their setup at the moment with that kind of back five at the moment. Almost you don't play him. I don't think he comes into contention. I don't think he can carry him like Bruno and Ronaldo when we're talking about in terms of their physical contribution out of possession, in terms of the qualities which they have, in terms of that press and just energy levels out of possession.
So why did he play him?
I think for the reasons that Nathan said, for the qualities that we know that he has, like in possession, we speak about Fred and McTominay when they play in there. You know, United just really can't wrestle control on that area of the pitch, can't dictate the play, can't really play through the towards for obvious reasons. Fred and McTominay don't have those qualities. So you put Pogba there, you have a player who can receive the ball on the half turn, who can dictate play. Got a great range of pass, and he's got that kind of killer ball. He can link up well with Bruno. I think he's the only player Bruno Fernandes looks down the pitch and thinks he can trust to get on the ball and find him higher up the pitch in those pockets. I think when Bruno, I'm talking about Bruno coming deep into midfield, I think the reason Bruno comes deep into midfield, he looks down, he sees Fred McTominay and thinks, they're not going to get me the ball high up the pitch. So he actually drops in there, gets, and he's the one hitting those 30 yard diagonals to Ronaldo, trying to find Ronaldo. So I think potentially Pogba has always been that key player, that kind of magic man in that central area of the pitch. But we've been saying it for so long now, I actually think that, you know, that's it's just moved on a little bit now. I don't see him as the future now, Pogba. But unfortunately, the future in that central midfield area isn't in the football club at all. At the moment, they're going to have to go and find that and bring, if not one, two players in the summer.
So they go back to the Spurs midfield for the Manchester City game, I suspect, if you were picking the team.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think Fred and McTominay will come in there. It's just interesting where they he goes to that front two again, Cavani and Ronaldo, and where he fits Fernandes into the team. I still think Fernandes, even that back five, you can play Fred McTominay in a two, you can play Ronaldo and Cavani up front, and you can still accommodate Fernandes in that pocket. So then you go back to almost like a split striker thing. You push the front two apart. A bit like when Solskjaer first came in and he played with those split strikes, and he played with a back three, if you remember. But when you play with those split strikers, all that I'd say, invariably you're looking for pace from those front players, because you're looking for them to split and get on the shoulders of the opposition centre half.
That's sort of what France, if we go back to that Nations League final, where they had Griezmann dropping deep and then they had Benzema and Mbappe as the front two. That actually, you want Fernandes almost as that Griezmann figure, that bit further up the pitch. Because Steve McManaman mentioned it in commentary last night, that he was dropping so deep at times that United were getting it out of defence quite quickly, But then Fernandez was coming back on the halfway line and was almost slowing it down. Instead of being the one who was affecting and getting it to Ronaldo and getting it to forward player quickly, as you say, maybe he didn't trust the midfield players to find that pass. He wanted to be the one to find a pass from deep every time, but it almost had the opposite effect of making United less creative.
Yeah, but when you play with that narrow three, which they did last night with Bruno on the right, out of possession, you have to drop in. You have to actually drop into an orthodox wide midfield position and get in contact with your wing back. You're actually drawn back into those deep midfield areas. The position we're talking about him operating behind potentially Cavani and Ronaldo in his central area is he hasn't got those responsibility, Nathans, to drop into those kind of wide areas. You know, he can occupy that kind of central area of the pitch and kind of stay in contact with the front two. All I'd say with that is, though, you're putting a huge amount of stress on that midfield too then. You haven't got the security blanket, that extra, that towards central midfield player, and that's a huge extra workload on those midfield too. And if you have the two best central midfielders in the world, if you had a combination of N'Golo Kante and a Matic at his prime in that central area, do you know what? You'd probably be able to get away with it. But a pairing of McTominay and Fred, as mobile as they are, I still don't feel as if any one of those two players is a natural defender. So that's what I'm talking about. They're the ongoing issues
The issues are that you could almost sit here and go through 1 to 11 Manchester United and question every player and their role and their form and what they're doing. One more, Harry Maguire. His absolute collapse in form, his constant mistakes, match after match. He looks totally devoid of any confidence. Even at the very end last night, I don't know if you noticed, there was Atlanta weren't pressing for a winner or anything after Ronaldo got the equaliser, but it was just a harmless enough ball played towards the edge of the area. And you could look, he's looking around, you could see the absolute panic that something was going to go wrong. What do you do as Solskjaer in a position like that with your captain, with this hugely experienced player who had felt as though was about to go on to another level after the Euros? Like, do you take him out of the fire and rest him, or can United afford to do that?
Well, that's a massive decision taking him out. Funny enough, I was watching a bit of the Villa game the other night, and that was Tyrone Mings on the bench, their captain, parked on the bench for a game. So that can be a massive decision. I was looking at his face, you could tell he wasn't too happy. So that's a big decision to make, to take one of your senior players and your captain out of the team. I think the answer is he'll try and protect them, which is actually what he's doing by reverting back to the back three and really narrowing up that defensive block, the five. He's actually protecting Maguire, you know, getting Varane a little bit closer to him. Usually plays left of three, does he, Maguire? And getting Luke Shaw narrowed up as well and operating a lower defensive block. We spoke about Spurs, that lower defensive block. That's exactly what you want to see. When you're a defender and you're not particularly quick, the most mobile, you don't want to see big distance between you and your goalkeeper behind you. You want to get yourself as close to the 18-yard box as possible so you can't get done in behind from balls in behind. So that's what we're seeing a little bit of late with United. And I think part of that is to kind of protect Maguire to a certain extent. I think even Lindelof, I don't think he trusts 100% either. So I think they looked a little bit more comfortable against Manchester United. Not so much last night. Obviously, Varane's off the pitch last night, and that they got an issue. Even that second goal last night, I mean, it was Boy's fault. There's a path to goal, just, you know, simple ball over the top. Boy has to do better. Sometimes I look at Boy, I'm not too sure what pictures he's seeing. I think possibly he's trying to nick the ball in front, which he likes to do. He's very aggressive. But, you know, Zabat just spun in behind him and he was in. But if you look at Maguire's position, I just felt could have been a little bit closer to him. I never like to see big distances between me two centre-halves. Just felt as if Maguire needed to be across the pitch a little bit, and he has to, because his recovery speed is not good. That's Varane in Maguire's shoes last night. He eats the ground up. He had 20 yards to make up there. He makes up the ground and he actually nicks that ball off the toes of Bae. Hasn't got that recovery speed, Maguire, but he's usually a good reader of the game, Maguire. I'll give him that. He reads situations well. So that kind of marries up in terms of that kind of lack of speed that he has. But it is an issue in confidence as well, I think, is the biggest thing now. He's lacking confidence. He's kind of making mistakes. I wouldn't say he's rabbiting the headlights at the moment, but he's struggling a little bit of confidence. So I think even with Varane out, which it looks like it's going to be the case at the weekend,
and Lindelof possibly as well. So, I mean, you may not have an option to go three at the back.
Maybe, but I think if Lindelof's fit, I could see Luke Shaw dropping in left side of the three. Yeah, Maguire going right, Wan-Bissaka and Telles coming in just to keep that kind of back, just to keep those distances small between that back five. And the big reason being just to give Maguire that bit of protection, give him an opportunity to kind of rebuild that confidence a little bit.
So, not to labour the point now, so you are definitely thinking that the three at the back is the best way for United to proceed, because there was the sense last night that maybe even for a while that, okay, this was down to Greenwood being introduced rather than going to back four, but it did seem that there was a greater impetus to Manchester United once they were forced into that change away from the back three. Maybe even only temporarily, but it seemed positive at the time last night.
I think temporarily, for me, no, I wouldn't be sticking with it, because right. by playing with the front two, basically you're saying Ronaldo plays and only one of... say Rashford, Martial and Greenwood for me is the absolute key. He's probably spoken about him for more. He's the one for me who's like, you know, could be absolutely anything. He's the one who could develop into an absolute world class striker, but we just don't know it yet. We haven't quite seen him enough of him, particularly in that central striking role. So by playing with the back five, basically you're sacrificing one of those forward players, and Greenwood's going to have to pay the penalty for that again. Parked again last night, even though they played with a three last night, again Bruno has to play, Ronaldo has to play. You're talking about one position again, even yeah. with a front three last night, and Rashford got the show. So for me personally, no, I can understand at the moment the back four for the reasons that we said, but for me still they've got to get back to that back four, midfield three and that front three, such as the attacking quality, the quality which they have within the squad. Get your best three up the pitch and just get that best dynamic in that midfield three area. It's never going to be perfect. It's got its limitations, but just pick the best balance you can in that midfield three area. But get your best three attackers on the pitch. And Greenwood, for me, is one of them. Just he still has moments in the game coming off the bench last night. You just feel as if, well, there's a top-class player in there and a top-class finisher as well, as we've seen. And I think there's more to come from him. But he needs game time. It's as simple as that. And this is another issue we've probably spoken about before, Ronaldo coming in and how it affects his game time, Greenwood going forward, particularly in that central striking position, which was an area I felt potentially he could develop into that kind of top class central striker. But I don't think he's going to get too many opportunities, certainly not this season with Ronaldo's presence.
Just one last question on the defence for me anyway. Would you be interested in seeing maybe a Bailly-Varane combination at some point if everybody's fit over the course of the next month? Because he's been getting a lot of credit from the Manchester United fans last night, Eric Bailly.
No, I'm not a huge fan of him. He's got some good qualities. Like I said, he's very mobile, quite dynamic in his movement. He's very aggressive, what I like to see. And by aggressive, I don't mean he's looking to fight the world. I mean, he wants to get tight to people. He's not prepared just to allow centre forwards to have the ball and drop off. He likes to nick things in front at times, make it into a physical battle. And that's all well and good, but you can't do that all the time. You can't win the ball every single time. Sometimes the danger's in behind. Even that first goal last night, I don't know if you remember, the ball got played into Zapata down the inside left channel. Again, he was trying to nick it off the front. The ball got kind of deflected in behind. But again, it was all about, I want to win this off the front. And good strikers will read you. You know, they lean into you, they push off the ball, they'll threaten to go short, they'll spin in behind, and they'll catch it out. So no, I wouldn't be Boye's biggest fan, to be honest with you, because those qualities that I'm talking about haven't changed for the whole of the time. He's reasonably young, but he's not that young now.
Yeah.
And he hasn't really changed as a player. So no, I don't think he's the answer. I just don't think, apart from Varane, I still think potentially Maguire, he finds that little bit of confidence, and you protect him to a certain extent in terms of players around them. I still potentially think that's the best pair in which they have, Maguire.
Right. Mad, you're talking about the Manchester United captain having to protect him.
But that's always been the case. I mean, I was saying that even when he first came into the football club. Again, he's got some wonderful qualities. Great, probably one of the best ball playing centre halves there is around, dominant in the air. And I think he's a very good read of the ball, which you have to be, because like I said, I mean, I played the game, I'm not comparing myself to Harry Maguire, but I was very one paced as well. I had no speed as well, so I very much leaned upon just the ability just to, you know, read the game to a certain extent, anticipate where the ball was going to arrive, where players are going to run, so you could adjust your position early, give yourself an extra couple of yards. I think generally speaking, Harry Maguire does that quite well, but the same physical attributes which he has, which he can't change, you know, in terms of that ability to plant his foot and accelerate quickly over 5-10 yards, change his body weight, that's never going to change. You know, his speed over 20, straight line speed over 20-30 yards, you know what I mean, he's not going to change that over the next, no matter how much work he puts in the gym. So those fundamentals aren't going to change, so you have to kind of recognise that and maybe just modify things to a certain extent. Full back on your left hand side, centre half on your inside. That's why Varane's helped him. And I think when Varane first came in, first couple of games, that looked a real partnership. I think Maguire fed off him a little bit, actually grew in confidence, because he knew, do you know, I've got somebody here actually lightning Speedy Gonzalez alongside me. I don't have to worry about so much that ball over the top. He's going to get around on the cover all day of the week. But Varane comes out with a team, then those small frailties and that central defensive area kind of rear their head. And when you make a few mistakes, as Nathan was saying there, and you lose a bit of confidence as well, that's a difficult position to be in, particularly a club like Manchester United when the microscope's on you.
You mentioned in the context of Paul Pogba that they sort of dithered over his future a little bit in the summer, that they should have handed him a contract. I guess there's certain elements of that you can read into around the club as a whole, and I think there's certain attributes about that you can bring into the Solskjaer conversation as well, about perhaps not being proactive if they did want to replace him. And maybe this week will be reflected on as a week where that is epitomised, because you've got Antonio Conte going to Tottenham. Now time will tell, but is your sense that Manchester United really missed a boat here, that had they actually made a swift decision on Solskjaer last week and got Conte in, that this season would turn out a lot better than it will under Solskjaer?
Well, obviously we'll never know Conte. You know, I'm a huge fan of Conte. I just feel as if personality, I think in terms of how he sets up his teams defensively to play, and that's still a big part of the game for me. The best managers get it right in and out possession in the football, and generally the best teams as well. So yeah, I'm a huge fan of Conte, and we're lucky United in terms of those defensive structure of the team. I think there's a general agreement there that it could be better. I think someone like Conte kind of remedies that pretty quick, although I think he struggles to remedy the things that we're talking about, the frailties in the Manchester United team at the moment. But now look, it hasn't happened. I didn't think it would. I didn't envisage Solskjaer's exit over the next kind of couple of weeks. I pretty much think he's reasonably secure till the end of the season, and we'll see what kind of impact that'd be very interesting that Conte makes at Tottenham Hotspur as well. But yeah, it's just a story that's going to run and run Manchester United. I don't know if it's peer too negative. I hope that's not the case, because like I said, they're an absolutely exhilarating team to watch at times.
Exhilarating enough though. I kind of felt at the start of the season that it would pan out somewhat like this, that they probably wouldn't be quite good enough to win the league or maybe contend, but they'd be just such a good attacking force that there'd be so much exciting football at Old Trafford that would get Solskjaer through. But even that hasn't really happened.
Moments I'm talking about. When I'm talking about quality football, I'm not talking about from front to back, playing through the tours, playing this wonderful football, you know, link up play between defence, midfield. You know, we're not going to say that for the reasons that we're saying, the deficiencies which they have in that central midfield area. But once they get the ball, Nathan, to that final third of the pitch, and get those combinations going, Bruno, Ronaldo, Greenwood, Rashford, all of that type of thing. Sancho, if he finds a little bit of form and confidence as well. We've seen it already. We've seen some spectacular goals. That bit of combination play for the first goal last night was absolute magic between the three lads. So I think we're going to see plenty of that. And I think we're going to see plenty of goals. But you're right, it's not going to be this kind of total football, you know, real great balance in the team when they're in possession and, you know, playing through the throw, and real cohesion to their play, to their football. I just think we're going to see brilliant moments, some great combinations from those kind of star players higher up the pitch, and that'll keep him in the mix, Nathan, at the top.
He's not to overreact on both sides, even with that Rio Ferdinand reaction. I was watching a BT last night of, easily this Saturday we could be talking about Ronaldo and the effect that he has on Manchester United set up if they lose that game, that there are going to be these massive sways, it feels, with Manchester United. Actually, if Solskjaer is staying, we just have to accept that this is what they are.
Yeah, you've got to be more objective than that. I don't know, fair enough. I admire a little bit, to be honest with you. I hear a couple of I don't listen to a lot, to be honest with you, the English media. I don't listen to it a lot, but in terms, there's clearly a togetherness there amongst that group of Manchester United players, Solskjaer, Neville's, Rio. They're kind of all together, so you could argue that their opinion, they're a little bit compromised in terms of what they have to say, even after this period of time. In some respects, I actually think, well, fair play. It just goes to show you what a tight group they had at that particular time, how together they were, that dressing room, even like whatever it is 15 years later. The natural inclination of some of these players is immediately, I've got your back, Do you know what I mean? Now, some people see that, oh, well, you're lucky.
Don't charge me 50 quid a month for the pleasure then, Kenny.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Punditry, to be objective here.
But I admire that, so in a way, because it goes to show how tight that wasn't just all talk. That's, again, there's not dressing room under Ferguson. It was real. It was tangible, and it's actually still there. So I understand that to a point, but at the end of the day, you have to detach yourself away from that and obviously look at it in the cold light of day. So I wouldn't agree with Ferdinand's comments there, because I think there's a halfway house there in terms of recognising the qualities which he has. Nobody's like talking down Ronaldo in terms of he doesn't do enough high intensity runs, or the energy isn't there in his legs. That's just a fact, you know what I mean? That's not a criticism. It's just he's 36, 37 years of age. It'd be ridiculous if it wasn't that kind of drop off, you know what I mean? He'd be superhuman. So it's just a case of noting that, recognising that, but also making the argument that, well, really, we have to find a place for him in the team, and how do you modify things around them, you know, to get the very best out of him, but at the same time the defensive structure of the team remains intact as well. Now, that's not easy, to be honest with you. I don't think that's a lot of criticism for Ronaldo. Solskjaer is getting a lot of criticism, but that's not easy for even a top class manager. I'm talking about Conte coming in at Manchester United. I think he would get him better, but I don't think there's an obvious fix there in terms of the players that he has. That's still not easy.
Right.
Although I think, to be fair, I think if you look at what Conte did, sorry, just to dwell on Conte, when he came into Chelsea, when he won that league title in his first season there, he came into the team there and the balance of the team wasn't great there. David Luiz, you're talking about kind of Harry Maguire just in a moment. I mean, David Luiz as a defender there was just like scatty. Now, he was like reasonably quick, David Luiz, but concentration levels, decision makings, all about hurting him and scaring him all over the place. A great distributor ball, but not a great defender. But yeah, Conte recognised, this is somebody I want in my team. Yeah, he's not the greatest defender, potentially 1v1. He kind of switches off, but I still want him in my team. How do I get him into my team? So he went from a flat back four quite quickly when he came into Chelsea, went to that back three, put David Luiz in the middle, put his two best defenders either side of him, Aspilicueta and Cahill it was, and kind of protected him in that respect. Got the wing backs into the team, Kante, I think Matic even was there at the time. So he put something, he put a template there on the pitch to say, I want to get David Luiz on the pitch. He's got some outstanding qualities, personality, range of distribution, can get me from back to front quickly, but how do I protect them? So this is what he did. He actually went to the back three, got his two best defenders alongside him. So you get the best of solutions. You have to kind of figure it out. But he did it at Chelsea, and he went on to win the league that kind of fourth season. And Solskjaer's got similar problems there in that kind of central midfield kind of axis, and at centre half at the moment. He needs to find a few kind of quick solutions as best he can, at least paper over the cracks as best he can.
Making those parallels between Chelsea and Manchester United is not going to do Manchester United fans any favours this morning, because it sounds like Antonio Conte could almost fix the problems that you pointed out there. But it's really hard to sort of decipher that as the season goes on. Two very different situations. Just one question on that: have you ever, you know, decided not to bury a teammate when you're doing your punditry gigs? Was there a tight knit community within your dressing room?
Listen back to his analysis after Ireland played Gibraltar.
No, but people do say it, don't they? Even say the international one, Nate, when you first come out, because the lads you've played with are still, it takes probably around 6, 8, 10 years for that group to move on, and that new batch. So it's not as if you're waiting for the new batch to come in, right, I can hammer a few people there. Certainly not. And the international thing's different. You're always that little bit, you know, we're all together, we all want the same thing. But I think there is a little bit of that. Don't get me wrong, some players more than others now, to be honest with you, that you played with. Some players would have driven you absolutely mad. But I still think, yeah, there is. I think you're right, actually. There is that little bit of thing about when you're in the kind of dressing room together and you've spent time in the dressing room together, when you come outside of that and you're as a pundit and you're talking about that same player, I think it is. There is still a little bit of that. You have to fight it and you try and push it to the side, Nathan. Well, this is it now. You know, I'm an analyst now, you know, I've got to be neutral in terms of my assessments and my critique and all that type of thing. But I think deep down there is a little bit of that. I think you can do both, Nathan. I think you can be critical, you can give an honest, objective opinion, but I think it's how you flare up, is how you project it, isn't it? How you deliver it. Your language really, I think, matters. You know what I mean? I think it can hurt a little bit. Next teammate coming with the big hammer, I think can hurt. So I can be a little bit conscious of that. Not so much now, not so much my ex-teammate. That's well, how many next things. Well,
you've brought us beautifully onto our next talking point this morning, Kenny Cunningham. Damien Duff is in as Shelburne manager. I mean, we haven't seen any games under his management so far. So I think you're immune from.
Is it done?
He's going to be unveiled today at lunchtime.
Oh, he's gone. So he's not Shelburne manager. We're making a big jump here.
No, he will be unveiled today. First of all, your initial reaction when he saw this during the week that he was going in for his first manager's job?
Yeah, I think it's great. Yeah. I think it's great in a load of different levels. I think it's a good move from Damien's point of view. Obviously, he's proven himself at it at different levels, underage level, both at Shamrock Rovers and Shelburne. You only have to speak to people around those clubs and around the teams he's been involved in terms of the impact that he's had. And obviously, even his time at Celtic, working alongside Neil Lennon, spoke to Neil a couple of times briefly, just working, and again spoke very highly of Damien. So I think this is a kind of natural step for him. I don't think it was a step he was desperate to make. A lot of young managers, this is where they want to be, fiercely ambitious. I want to be the manager, the governor, the number one. Don't think genuinely that's the case with Damien. I don't necessarily think that motivates him, but I think there's certain advantages of having that position in terms of the control which it gives you, in terms of, right, this is how we're going to do things, it's my way or the highway, and that can trickle down to all the teams underneath, even their underage level as well. So there's a huge amount of more responsibility there, but it does surprise me that he's taking it on. I think it's the right decision for him. I think it's a good club. I think they're on the way up. I think they have some good investment behind them, so I think it's a good situation for him to start, and I think it's great for the league. Yeah. I think the league's in a really good place at the moment. I've been watching again this year, trying to get around to as many games as I can, but I think if you even look from a managerial point of view, like Steve and O'Donnell Allen matches, that combination at St. Pat's, we're already going back in at Derry City, a lot of investment coming in now from the owner, seems to be putting a lot of investment at Derry. Liam's doing a great job, more experienced manager down in Sligo. Sligo traditionally always been a great football club down there as well. Rovers, we know, are now doing phenomenal. Dundalk, we're expecting a bit of bounce back from them as well. Even the likes of Darragh Doyle up in Drogheda had a great season. Mark Beardsham, young coach, you know, young managers coming into the league, you know, doing well. Squads are improving, a real competitive edge to the league. And now Damien comes in on top of that, and he'll make a contribution as well, I'm sure, in terms of first of all, obviously within the football club of Shelburne and the first team squad, but also indirectly the ripple effect of that around the league as well. So I think it's fantastic on a lot of different levels.
There's nothing about Damien Duff that just doesn't bring a smile to your face. I don't know if it's just my generation. You think back to him as a player, that you want him to do well, and it's just going to be fascinating to see how it works out, because he's gone through a lot of different gigs over the last few years, and the one thing you get a sense from, and you obviously know him, is that he doesn't suffer fools. And being a League of Ireland manager, there's a bit of, you just got to get on with it. Like, he obviously left the Ireland job very quickly. It seems that as much as he was annoyed by what went on with the video and the reaction to the video, also quite frustrated with maybe his general dealings with the FAI, even with his involvement at Shells at underage level, that there's a bit of sucking it up at the as a manager that you got to do, that maybe he hasn't really wanted to do and hasn't needed to, because he's probably, I don't know, on a personal level, in a, you know, safe enough financial situation. He doesn't need this job. He's doing it because he wants to do it. That you hope he actually goes and sees this through, because you're right. It does feel it's what the league needs to bring it to the next level next season, is a proper competition. I think it's one of the reasons that maybe Rovers haven't got the respect, is that it's been a little bit too easy for them this year. They haven't been outstanding, and they still won the league comfortably. That actually, I really hope Duff does see this through over the next couple of years and does bring Shells to another level.
Yeah, I think he will. And again, it's quality of coaching as well, I think. Maybe that's a little bit too strong to go as far as to say, is something which could have been levelled in terms of the league, the quality of coaching players maybe are getting on a day-to-day basis. But those young managers now, and Damien in particular, you know, if you're a young player and you're coming to Shelburne, you know the quality of coaching that you're going to get from Damien, that's pretty much a given. So hopefully that cabal of players underneath him at Shelburne, you know, their quality will improve, and I'm sure they'll feed their way around the league as well. This is what I'm talking about, the kind of ripple effect of having somebody like that, a good coach, someone who for me is actually a very good coach, not just somebody of standing, somebody who players are going to walk into the dressing room and think, wow, this is Damien Duff, and his words are going to carry weight. I understand that, but also in terms of the minutiae I'm talking about, in terms of the quality of coaching that they're going to get on a day-to-day basis on the training pitch, that's exciting as well. So I'm just interested in the first time he's on a live game, and that, you know, that ball's ballooned out of the fence from a defender over towards the dugout. It's coming towards him, and everybody's looking at him. Come on, Duffy, show us something. Show us something. How's your touch? He's going to be under massive pressure just to trap that ball coming out of the sky.
Yeah, well, the thing that's been reported already this morning is Duff's going to bring players back for pre-season before Christmas. That there's going to be morning sessions.
As late as that.
There's going to be morning sessions. So I guess it kind of changes the whole view of professionalism, maybe to a point at the club. He does seem to be a man who drives incredible standards, and we even saw it at underage level at Shamrock Rovers for a while.
Is he a bit old school?
Well, that's right, and that'll
without
be
going all Eddie Jones on it. What's old school?
Yeah, but that's one of the challenges now, isn't it? He's going into like a professional, people might say a semi kind of environment. A couple of the League of Ireland clubs are on the borderline there, Nathan, aren't they? Mm. Semi professional and kind of professional. And Shells probably wouldn't have been one of those teams for the past a couple of years. That may change going forward. Might be one of the things Damien says when he comes in, look, I need to get hold of these players 5 days a week, all week, you know what I mean? We've got to go fully professional here. You need a big hit in terms of investment here. This is what I'm kind of demanding, because I'm going to put huge demands on these players. Possibly what you're talking about. I think it's easy for like a 15-year-old to kind of turn the screw when he's got his mat to drop him off maybe 6:30 in the morning for an early session and stuff like that. Not so easy in terms of maybe to get the buy-in from the older players, but I think you will get it, because I think very quickly if the players look at someone like Damien and think, this lad, he's got basically, yeah. What it is, as a player, I always felt a new manager comes in, the fundamental that was going around in my head initially, I was always looking at him thinking, can you make me a better player? If I listen to you, if do exactly what you say over the period of time, will you make me a better player? And if the answer to that is yes, you get a sense of that very early when a manager comes in the door, in terms of what he's saying, in terms of what he's laying down on the training pitch, the work that he's doing collectively with the group, the individual work that he's doing with you, individual analysis and all that type of thing, that's kind of blowing you away, and you're thinking, oh my God, if I stick with this fella, I'm going to be twice the player I am now in a year and a half. I think that's it. I think then you get the buy-in, then you turn up at 6 o'clock in the morning for a weight session, or down the gym at the airport or whatever it is. You don't mind that kind of double session in the afternoon, because you're getting better, the team's getting better, they're being more competitive in the league, and the world's your oyster.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out. We've got plenty of reaction as well, which you'll get to throughout the morning on Manchester United and on Damien Duff, but we are chatting to Andy Mitten in just a moment. We'll take a quick break. OTB AM. You're welcome back. It is 8:17 on this Wednesday morning. It's Owen, Kenny Cunningham and Nathan Murphy with you. Andy Mitten was in Bergamo last night. We'll get to him in just a moment. But first, here's Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
You know, we all have roles and responsibilities. And of course, Cristiano's a leader in the group. But of course, that's what he does. He scores goals. We're not happy conceding two goals. Both of them are very, very fine margins. I think the first one should be off. The second one is a centimetre onside. Is probably maybe offside in last season. So it's fine margins. But he does provide those moments. And I'm sure Chicago Bulls didn't mind having Michael Jordan either. So, you know, sometimes teams have the players they have, and that's why they are at Man United, and that's why they are champions in Chicago Bulls. You just come up with those moments. And for me, I know there's votes coming up, or Cristiano is just getting better and better for us. He's feeling better. You know, he's not had a proper pre-season. Now he's getting better and better, and he's feeling up to speed now.
So Cristiano Ronaldo, Michael Jordan, Andy Mitten, are Manchester United anywhere near the Chicago Bulls is my question.
I'll give you a one-word answer if you want, and it isn't yes.
Who's Scottie Pippen?
Scott McTominay.
McTominay. How is the general feeling this morning, Andy? I was watching you doing your two-minute match report last night. You were saying that the Manchester United fans who were there were in full song, fully supportive of the manager, but this is just a continuation of the uncertainty, I guess, of where this team is going last night.
Yeah, well, it's raining today, as it was the day before the game. But yesterday, I think the United fans enjoyed a beautiful city. But 10 minutes before the end of the game, an announcement came over that, well, you're going to be kept in for 1 hour after the match. And the team were 2-1 down. And you could just say, oh, no, this is just another bad night. And then Cristiano was equalised, as he'd done in the first half. I think it was a good result. It wasn't a good performance. It showed character. But it was a good result because it keeps United top of the group stage. I'm not looking at this United team thinking going to St. Petersburg in May, because the team still looks well short of the standard of the absolute best. But after the bad start in this group, to be top of it after four group games, you've got a difficult game at Villarreal away coming up, and then you've got the home game against Young Boys. United aren't beating Young Boys at home. They don't deserve to be in the Champions League. So it was a decent result. Was I worried watching it? Yes, I was, especially in the first half. I thought Paul Pogba, who had a chance, he needed to take it. He didn't. He lost possession several times. He's not going to be figuring because he's suspended after that sending off against Liverpool. I thought Eric Bailly, who came in, played in a three and a four at the back. He was probably United's best defender. Was worrying losing Raphael Varane because he's one of the best defenders in the world. David De Gea, one of the best players this season. He had a bad night in Bergamo. He was really poor for the first goal, and the second goal, I'd like to see it again because I was only in the stadium when I saw it, but that looked like he just gave the goal scorer a big wide goal rather than closing the gap down. So on balance, I think it will be seen as a successful European away trip, in so much as fans could attend, did attend, enjoyed it in a good city. The hosts were friendly. The atmosphere was fantastic. The ground only holds 21,000, but it was bouncing. We knew it would be good, and it was good. I think Atalanta are a good team. They're not a great team. You're not going to be expecting them to be in the final. But they've become Champions League regulars. I like the way that they play football. And, you know, United knew what was coming. United's game plan. And knew that Atalanta are like Leeds, but better, if you like, in terms of the style that they play. They press, they're aggressive. And United never really got to grips with that. Even though United shaded it with possession and had spells of dominance, you felt that if it was a better team, then they would have put Manchester United out of sight.
Andy, there's a touch of Groundhog Day around the entire Manchester United conversation, but particularly around Paul Pogba. I'm just wondering, from your knowledge of the club, what the attitude towards Pogba is, considering the issues with his contract and the performances and the inconsistency and the stupidity and the lack of discipline against Liverpool with the red card, and then, as you say, a big opportunity given him last night in that midfield too, and just the real casualness of his play, that here's a world talent who's been hauled off at a time of real need for Manchester United with 25 minutes still to go in the game.
Well, he had a chance, and I knew that he was asked to make sure he did his tracking runs right, that he defended right. Clearly, the manager was looking for moments of genius from him. It wasn't really happening. I mean, I thought he was really poor. I thought he was poor trying to dribble the ball away from his own area. Wasn't surprised when he came off. And at this moment, Manchester United need discipline. They needed it at Spurs on Saturday. And they need it to stop leaking all the goals, and the midfielders play a big part in that defensive role. And Pogba failed last night. And what's his current situation? Well, he's got a contract offer from Manchester United, which is very, very good. Thought it was interesting last night when he went off the pitch. I didn't see a single person applaud him off the pitch in that United end. And he does have the contract offer. He's given no indication as to whether he will or will not sign it yet. He could leave the club for free in June. He could start talking to other clubs in January. And there are plenty of United fans who would say, well, good riddance. And there are plenty who would say he's worth persevering with. He, as you said, he's a world-class talent. He can do things that no other player can really do. Well, Ronaldo now, that's changed it a little bit. For Manchester United, I've understood that he's been open to signing a new contract for all of this year. But what does that actually mean? Pay us enough money and I'll sign a new contract. And I spoke to one leading agent about Pogba's situation, and he said there's not so many clubs who'd buy Paul Pogba for a fee, but there are a lot more clubs who'd have him for free. And I think that's a fair assessment of where we're at. I spoke to him after the Atalanta home game. He was in good form. He's polite, as he always is. He's not a big negative influence in the dressing room, and you know, he's just one of them players who, in the great United teams, the fans have said, yeah, you know, X player's brilliant, Y, but, and you run through almost the whole team, and they just don't do that about Paul Pogba. And last night, as you said, was a perfect example why. He let his team down.
The part of your brain or the part of the fan group, whatever it is, that are saying that no to good riddance to Paul Pogba, those who want Paul Pogba to stay, what is the main part of the reasoning behind that in your view?
Because they watch him for France and see how good he is, because there has been times when he has been good. He was Manchester United's top scorer only a couple of years ago. He's clearly talented. You know, he's a world champion playing in a very good team. The best pass I've seen all season, all year, this calendar year, was Paul Pogba for France in Munich against Germany to set up their goal. And I left the ground in Munich thinking, why can't I do this more often for Manchester United? There's moments when he does do it, when United hit the top of the table at the start of this year. He was scoring some key goals. And I think he's a likeable person. You know, I know enough people who know him who don't come to me and say, this guy's is a real problem. They just don't do that. But from his perspective, he's doing what he did last time. He signed a contract. He will fulfil that contract and he will exercise his right to sign a new contract if he wants to do that, or move if he wants to do that as well. And it's a situation which is full of really strong arguments for and against. You know, you might say he's a Manchester United player, but there's no evidence in his bios on social media that he plays for Manchester United. There's not a song for him, not a real song which fans sing about him. And, you know, if he moved somewhere else, you just won't be surprised if he was one of the best players and started winning all those individual awards, which he's not been close to winning while he's been at Manchester United. It wasn't supposed to be like this. He was supposed to be the talisman. The team was supposed to be built around him when he came back in 16, and a major reason why Manchester United would return to greatness.
Andy, sorry, do you mind if I jump in, staying on that kind of central midfield theme, just moving away from Pogba a little bit? He's never going to be that kind of central midfield defensive linchpin. We know that. We know the qualities which he has. But Manchester United, we think, we all know, worst kept secret, they've been crying out for that top class holding, defensive, whatever you want to call it, central midfield player, basically since Solskjaer's come into the football club. Has Solskjaer ever been pinned by any journalist at any time in terms of, does he believe that the players that he has in that central midfield area are good enough, or he's happy with, or has he actively looked to reinforce in that area of the pitch and has been denied by maybe the board or people above him? Because that's the area of the pitch where the whole balance, the whole dynamic is wrong. They haven't got one player in that central midfield area who they can really trust in terms of his defensive qualities, and it doesn't look as if they've been overly active in the transfer market and bringing that type of player into the football club. Van de Beek's not that type of player. Fred is not that type of player. He's been there for quite some time. We know Pogba isn't a Matic. His legs have gone now. He was that type of player. He isn't anymore. So whose responsibility is it? Has that responsibility been taken away from Solskjaer, or does Solskjaer genuinely believe that a pairing of McTominay and Fred in central midfield is going to be the future for Manchester United, is going to elevate them to a league title potentially?
Yes, journalists have asked him about the midfield on a very frequent basis. Yes, Manchester United have looked at bringing other midfield players in. Yes, he has been backed in the transfer market, bringing in Varane, Sancho, Ronaldo in the summer. You can absolutely argue, as I think you might do, that a priority should have been a central midfield player. United had to move players on, but you know, Matic is good. He's a good player, Matic. He's trusted, but he isn't Matic age 27. Fred and McTominay, Fred especially, are derided, but he trusts them as an insurance role. He knows that they're not the best midfielders in the world, that they don't compare to previous great Manchester United central midfielders. But
they need better, Andy, don't they? They need better. He's a tidy enough player, Fred, isn't he? And McTominay, it's not good enough. It's not going to take him where they want to be. It's not going to take him to a title, is it?
And they know that.
It's taken a long time, Andy, isn't it? It's taken too long. How long has he been there? Is it 2.5 years? I've forgotten. How long has he been there, Solskjaer? We've been having this Manchester United conversation, support, surely you included, have been having that conversation for a long time about the quality in that central midfield area. Who's got to come in? We've got to reinforce. We've got to get better. And it just hasn't happened. It's like 2-3 years in.
If we would have been speaking a year ago, we would have been saying that the right-hand side of midfield was more of a priority issue. I think now, absolutely right, that central midfield. Declan Rice is a player United have watched. They just couldn't go out and get him for the type of money West Ham would want for him in the transfer window. And I'm sure Declan Rice would love to come to Manchester United. Right back was another position. They tried to get Kieran Trippier. What do you do when Atletico Madrid say, we're not selling? You know, United brought three top players in this transfer window. That squad there now with all those players should still be doing better than what they are doing. The results in the last 5 or 6 weeks have not been anywhere near good enough. And the midfield has rightly come in under scrutiny, not just because Liverpool completely outclassed. I mean, I watched Jordan Henderson for Liverpool. He was absolutely fantastic. But Villarreal and Atalanta just swarming through. This isn't PSG, because that also happened last year. This is Villarreal and Atalanta at Old Trafford. And there were times last night where I felt, you know, Scott McTominay is really struggling here. Then again, for me, he was the best player on the pitch at Tottenham on Saturday. Definitely got something. Maybe that's more of a peripheral player. But if we're comparing these players to the likes of Roy Keane, who've played before, they're not coming close. They're not in the same league. And Manchester United should be in the league where they're not only competing for the Premier League or the Champions League, but winning it. And to do that, you need the best midfielders in the world. Your point's right. They are not at Manchester United at the moment. They've tried it with Pogba. They tried it with Pogba last night. What happened? He cost the team. He gave the ball away 3-4 times, I counted, in the first half alone. So, you know, we might have been talking about it for a long time, but Paul Pogba was supposed to be an option there, and that just hasn't worked out. And that can happen in football. Donny van de Beek, really interesting. Who signed Donny van de Beek? I don't think that Ole Gunnar at any point went out and said, this is the man I want. He's been offered him. The club have been offered him for a good price at the right time. And on paper, and I saw van de Beek for Ajax, he was really, really good. He's not playing. He came on for 5 or 6 minutes last night and was really, really good. But that was his first time that he'd been on the pitch in 7 or 8 matches. So it still is, as you're right to point out, it still is an area of contention for Manchester United. If you gave Ole Gunnar Solskjaer a fortune now and said, go out and bring any player in, I'm sure that would be the position that it would change.
I just want to put one comment to you, Andy, because I know you're under time pressure, but Mick has been in touch. He says, as a Manchester United fan, I think it's time you discussed the captaincy with Andy. It's the history of great captains of the club. You have to wonder how Harry Maguire fits the bill. Is that a reasonable criticism, do you think, Andy, in terms of his captaincy and even his position in the starting team at the moment?
I think it's an absolutely reasonable question. I'm sick of mentioning Roy Keane in this interview, but if you compare Harry with one of his recent critics, Roy Keane, I have my doubts. Maguire is the captain of Manchester United. He's been poor this year. I do rate him as a player. I think he was missed last year towards the end when he got injured at Aston Villa, was missed in Gdansk. And I see some evidence of captain material. You know, he went to Gdansk, he took his whole family with him. They went to hopefully see him win the Europa League. That didn't happen. But I have my doubts. I totally have my doubts. And I had my doubts last year when United were beaten 6-1 at Old Trafford by Spurs and Harry Maguire didn't go out and face the media. He has fronted up since then. He's not as energetic as like a Keane would have been. He's not as direct. But then again, if you are, every single word that you say is totally twisted. So what you see from him and also from the manager is like a calmness. And I'm not sure that's what fans always want to see. Sometimes they want to see, you know, that naked emotion coming out there and people saying that this is an absolute disgrace or whatever. It's football. You want to get wrapped up into it. And we don't often see that from Maguire. So I'm not going to say Maguire's the best ever captain for Manchester United because he's not. If he's going to become a legendary captain, he's got to do more than what he's doing. And maybe that's more of a presence on the pitch. But at the moment with him, when I was watching that game last night in Bergamo, my priority wasn't thinking of him as a captain. It was thinking of him staying on his feet because he was being pulled around. He was really, really struggling. There was far more energy in the players he was up against. Muriel, for example, there were times between the 80th and 90th minute where I thought, Maguire is becoming a liability on the pitch here. Now, I think he's having a bad time. I don't think he's a bad player. I think he will get over this difficult spell. Everyone has difficult spells, but his form is a bigger concern for me at the moment than his captaincy.
Andy, I'm interested that you use the word calmness there around Maguire and Solskjaer, and like, it's the one thing you would have to give Solskjaer a lot of credit, that the madness and the extreme reaction to everything that happens at Manchester United, he's always remained incredibly calm. He hasn't really fed into that in any way. That's certainly the impression that you're getting through the TV screen. He's under enormous, enormous pressure and one of the biggest jobs in world football. Have you seen it affect him in any way? Have you seen his personality change in any way? Has the pressure really been ramped up, and like, to the extent in the last couple of weeks people were fully expecting him to lose his job?
I think he handles it really well. Really, really well. I think he doesn't read social media. If he did, if he saw the abuse that he receives, well, we're into Steve Bruce territory there. And I don't think any manager should get some abuse. I saw an image last week from Syria, but one of them sort of images of Solskjaer had an orange coat on with somebody behind him as if he was going to behead him. I just thought, nobody deserves this. Why am I even seeing this? And he gets a lot of abuse. However, last night in Bergamo and at Tottenham on Saturday, United fans sang his name. Not non-stop, but almost non-stop. They were singing it before United went ahead at Tottenham. They were singing it last night, four or five songs about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. And yet, if you actually went into that away and then spoke to people individually, they'd all have doubts about Solskjaer. And yet they still support him. And he really appreciates that. I asked him about this last night. I said to him, has anyone actually come up to you and given you, you know, said you're not the man for this job? That hasn't happened to him. So it's to his credit that he deals with this intense pressure. And what people don't see, and I see this as a journalist, is after that game last night, people see the interview in their country. So I'm not sure who the rights holder is in the Republic of Ireland. But Solskjaer spends an hour doing 20 different interviews with different people, all of them trying to catch him out, all of them trying to come at him. And I think he does it well. And he doesn't give them the best lines. He gives people good lines. I quite enjoyed speaking to him after Atalanta at home. And he mentioned the fans in the Stretford End. So I tried to pinpoint him. What, the Red Army? Yeah, the Red Army with big old Pete over there. And I loved it because he relaxed a little bit. And maybe that's because he knows me. Wasn't particularly fair on big old Pete, because Pete Boyle isn't big anymore. He's lost a lot of weight. He goes running every day. To call him old, well, Ollie, I mean, he's a similar age to you. You know, you're going to call Ollie the old Norwegian. But I like that. I like that about him, that, you know, he does know the club, and that's not going to keep him his job if results aren't good enough. But he's under so, so much pressure. And sometimes he does keep coming out with the same lines. And sometimes people say, just give it a rest, Ollie, I'm sick of hearing this. But he can't give it a rest because he's contractually obliged to speak to the media. What can he do? At times he's between a rock and a hard place. I think in terms of dealing with the pressure, he's handling it well.
All right, Andy, great stuff as ever. Thanks a million for taking the call.
Thank you.
Cheers. Andy Mitten there on the line from Italy as Manchester United rescue a late draw. 2-2 was the full-time score last night. That was an interesting point at the end, Kenny, about Harry Maguire and the captaincy, and comparing Maguire and how maybe vocal and maybe a lack of fire and brimstone from him compared to, say, Roy Keane. Is that something that's important as a captain? Actually exerting that sort of level of passion just in your public utterances, let alone on the pitch?
No, I don't think it's vital. People captain as they see fit, and you have to remain loyal to your old kind of personality. You can't put kind of a face on, you know what I mean, at any particular moment. I just think with Maguire at the moment, I think what makes it difficult for a captain is like personal performance. I think when your personal performance kind of drops to a certain level, I think that's when it becomes very difficult for yourself personally, and also for the manager. I always felt when I kind of captained, when my performance has kind of dropped a little bit, found it very difficult to kind of maybe be as vocal. That wasn't as easy, because in the back of the head you're thinking, listen, you want to concentrate on yourself. You want to get your own game up to the level that it needs to be at before you start you know, telling other people and dictating to other people. So that's where Maguire is at the moment. I don't see
it. So it was very difficult for him to go into a United dressing room last night and look at Paul Pogba and go, yeah, you're meant to be the superstar of this team and you're getting hauled off after 65 minutes.
Yeah, I don't think he can do it. I don't think he can dig him out, because Paul Pogba was looking at him thinking, oh, hold on, Harry, steady. You know what I mean? Glass houses here. That's just the way it is, where if you're playing at a level, as a lot of captains, and obviously Roy's reference for obvious reasons, Roy's level, right? You can never look stare Roy out and say, hold on, Roy, you want to have a look at yourself. Roy be like, what exactly are you talking about? Well, that misplaced pass about 4 years ago. Like,
did you ever question Roy Keane?
Well, no, you couldn't for those reasons. But I don't necessarily think this kind of, oh, he needs to come on and be shouting and screaming and digging people out and showing that emotion.
English football loves that, though. They love the captain, leader, legend type.
Yeah, but it's all about the dressing room for me. It's not about how you project them necessarily all the time to your support base and, you know, the general public in general. It's all about your standing within the dressing room, relationship with the other players. That's the fundamental. That's the most important thing. So, and for me, it's like personal performance is a significant factor in that, and that's what he needs to focus on at the moment, Harry Maguire.
Yeah, for sure. I think we're going to go to John Duggan now this morning. I already know we're not. We're going to go to him in just a moment. So here's something new for you. The Coy Gig Pod on OTB Sports has just launched, and it is your one-stop shop for everything women's football, from the WSL to the Irish team and everything in between. Kathleen McNamee and Karen Duggan will have all the latest news, reaction and analysis every week, as well as some top-name guests. So next week, the one-woman goal machine that is Katie McCabe will join the pod. But kicking things off this week was Lucy Quinn. Having just made her Irish debut, she also made the decision this season to return to her first professional club, Birmingham, despite their issues off the field. Here's why.
This is your second spell. You re-signed during the summer. What was it that attracted you back to the club, especially when, I suppose, you look at last season with Birmingham? There were a lot of off-field issues, and it was quite public, and there was players who were unhappy. What was it about the setup now that you said, this is a team and a club and that I want to play with and I want to, I suppose, be associated with?
Yeah, obviously my first spell at Birmingham was my first professional contract, my first club. They really took a chance on me, I guess, kind of gave me the opportunity to play at this level. So Birmingham always had a special place in my heart, and I never left on any bad notes at all. I just wanted to go and test myself and put myself in new environments and develop. And I always said to the club that I would never be against coming back. So, yeah, when I found out that they were interested in the summer, that was definitely a conversation that I wanted to have. They made me feel valued, just as they did before. You know, they really make me feel like they appreciate me as a player and a person, which was really important to me. I was looking for a new challenge in my career, obviously being a bit older now, so being a bit more of a senior player. And I felt like that's what Blues needed. Blues needed players like myself or Louise to come in with a bit more experience and really help them get through this season. Again, with the off-the-pitch stuff, women's football is growing at such a phenomenal rate all the time that certain clubs, you know, often are playing catch up, and that's not necessarily their fault. That might be facilities wise, that might be funding wise or squad numbers, whatever it might be. Blues have really showed intent that we understand where the women's team is going. We understand that it is fully professional, and we value it massively as part of our club and in our communities, and that we're going to do everything that we can to support you girls. And that's a message that I received when I spoke about re-signing. And yeah, obviously some clubs are able to do that in a fortnight, and some clubs are going to have to take a little bit longer, but Blues are definitely on that journey, and I felt really positive about that.
Yeah, that's our brand new Coy Kick pod. That was Lucy Quinn in conversation with Karen Duggan and Kathleen McNamee. Brand new podcast out every single week, and as I say, Katie McCabe is going to be next week's guest, so you can subscribe to that right now.
He did stuff on episode one.
Oh yeah?
Emma Carroll, our own Emma Carroll, is a special guest star every week, picking her team of the week. But because there was no league games last week, Kenny, she picked her team of the season so far. And, got pretty heated pretty quickly. She left out Vivian Miedema from her...
That's a disgrace, first of all.
9 games so far for Miedema, possibly the best striker in the world right now. 9 games this season, 9 goals.
Who did she leave for?
For Arsenal.
Yeah, no, I know, but who did she leave her out for?
The Chelsea striker? But this is just outrageous. Mm. So, yeah, the Karen and Kathleen were not impressed by this at all. So.
I mean, I know Kathleen's an Arsenal fan, and I mean, but the media...
Outer on the very first episode as an Arsenal fan.
Ah, but there's nothing wrong with being outed as an Arsenal fan, Nathan. I mean, it happened to
there's
me on my first...
There's not much good about being outed as an Arsenal
fan. It happened to me
on
my first day on the job, you know.
Eddie McCabe on the show next Monday, eh?
Yeah, that'll be a big one. Keeping the Arsenal theme going immediately on the Coygeek pod, which I'd like to see. So that's available now on the OTB Sports app, episode one. Check it out. I think we got John Duggan with us now. How are you, John?
Owen, Nathan and Kenny, how are we doing?
Yeah, good. Will we kick things off this morning with virtual insanity, John?
Why not?
Let's do it. So, after last week's big win in the Bermuda Triangle, it delivered a storm for you.
Yeah, 60-1, Lucas Herbert, headline tip, 49% profit on the year with three tournaments to go. So, a little bit of a victory lap because it's been a frustrating year. So, eventually, it all came good in the end. So, anybody who has maybe looked at this or had a look at it, sincere thanks. It's really just to inform your opinion about what you want to do if you like to have a euro each way on one of these things responsibly. But I'm obviously feeling very confident ahead of the tournament tomorrow in Mexico, which is the Worldwide Technology Championship, which has got Shane Lowry, Seamus Power, Graham McDowell all in the field. Justin Thomas is in there, Brooks Koepka. A lot of really good golfers as we kind of get the new season. I know it's not still 2021, but the new PGA Tour season gets going. So what I've done virtually, I've gone for Scottie Scheffler as the main one at 33-1. We know how well he played at the Ryder Cup when he faced down John Rahm at the single. Scottie Scheffler, he's never won on the PGA Tour, could you believe? For somebody who was Rookie of the Year and three times in the top 10 of majors last season, amazing Scottie Scheffler has never won. But I think on his only tournament appearance in Mayakoba, where this has been played in Mexico, this resort course, he was in a tie for 18th. And I think Scottie Scheffler is due a win. I think he's overpriced at 33-1. He's the headline tip, Scottie Scheffler. These are all on otbsports.com and on the OTB app. The second one is the local boy, Abraham Answer, each way at 18-1 for five each way. Has been playing really well. Won in Memphis a few months ago. Was 14th on his last start. And three times he's been in the top 12 in this tournament, Abraham Answer. So a very tidy player, I think, is a good each-way selection, Abraham Answer. The third one is a bit of a gut feeling. Dylan Fratelli of South Africa, 125-1 for 4 euro each way. Only played here once, was 11th, was 22nd in Bermuda last week. Hasn't got really any kind of statistics that would back you to back him. But he was 5th at the Open, tied for 5th at the Masters. He's a habit of coming out of nowhere, Dylan Fratelli, who won the John Deere Classic a couple of years ago. And I went through three golfers at all at 66-1. Patrick Rogers, who was 4th last week and has got good course form. Russell Knox, who was 2nd and 3rd here a few years ago and played well last week. He was 12th at Bermuda. And Emiliano Grillo, who plays these greens, Paspalum greens, better than any other player on tour. He's not a very good putter. He's generally quite an average putter, which would put you off him. But on these greens, he was the 54-hole leader here last year. He'd been in the top 15 on four occasions in five starts. So Grillo at 66 with Russell Knox and Patrick Rogers. Fratelli at 125s, Answer at 18s. But the headline tip, folks, I think he's going to break through very soon, Scottie Scheffler.
Nice one. So he tees off at around 11:15 tomorrow morning there in Mexico. So, John, what else is happening this morning?
Well, it's all about Man United, lads. I hope you enjoyed that. It's a theme park. It's a fun fair. It's really entertaining for a neutral, I find. You can't take your eyes off it. It's appointment viewing. Maybe the Glazers like that. Maybe that's why Solskjaer are still there. It's absolute chaos. Great fun. Ronaldo, what, 5 goals now in 4 games in the Champions League and saving them again with a great volley last night. Pogba, you know, how long is he going to be there after the way he played in that match? And they got Man City on Saturday. It's going to be an absolute must-watch.
Yeah, you reckon that Tottenham were trolling Manchester United last night? Their social media manager was trolling Manchester United last night.
Well, it was odd that they put on about 3,000 Conte welcome tweets throughout the day. It looked like Bond villain stuff in a great way. Obviously, we're so thrilled that he's there and he's joined the club now, Antonio Conte. But when it was 2-1 to United in arrears, when Atalanta went 2-1 up, it was just this tweet that went out, which just said Conte with a signature and stuff. I thought it was kind of funny. And I just said, is this trolling? I suppose I'm so giddy at Conte going to Spurs because I think he's a real coup for them. If the big proviso is if Joe Louis and Daniel Levy let him do what he wants and give him some money and allow him to shape the team without interference, then I definitely think it's an exciting time for Spurs. And if I was a Man United fan, I would have liked to have Conte.
There were a lot of stories, obviously, yesterday about what's going to happen with Conte and what assurances he was given. And he seems to have this wish list, as always, of 6-7 players, the likes of Vlahovic from Fiorentina, who's probably going to cost 60-70 million. Does he get those 6-7 players and keep Harry Kane at the club? Or do you think, is that going to happen if Kane does go in January?
Well, I think he'll probably be allowed to have both. I don't think there's a condition that he has to sell Kane to get these players in. I think it's a funny thing. It's all about, like, life is funny when it comes to negotiations. In, say, the summer, maybe Tottenham had the upper hand. Now Tottenham are desperate. Daniel Levy's name is getting chanted. My nephew was there the other day at the United game, and he says the atmosphere was absolutely toxic. And not just against Nuno, who you'd have to feel a bit sorry for. I know, Kenny, you're a fan of Nuno. He lasted less time than Santini at the club. That's 124 days. I think a lot will depend on Kane's attitude. We're already getting the reports that he's excited about working with Conte. Of course he's going to be, because his contract is what? Still got another couple of years to go in it. And we know how hard a bargain that Daniel Levy drives. But you'd actually hope to get the best out of Kane, because at the moment his value must have depreciated. If his value was, say, 150 million in the summer, what's it now? 75, which is what City were offering originally, plus 25 million of add-ons. So Kane, for his own sake, whether he wants to stay at Spurs and try and win something with Conte or get a move elsewhere, needs to be playing better football than he has been playing. Whether he's demotivated or whether he hasn't just got into his groove. This is a guy who's the top scorer and the top assist maker in the Premier League last season. So I'm excited about it. I do think it could be Kane plus a few players, but who he's going to identify. They're all talking this morning that he's got the spine to look at. But I think Romero was a good sign in anyway, in defence. And it's just a case of, there's a lot of players there that, like Dyer's been there a long time. Like Bergwijn, you'd have to say, has he sparkled? Probably not. Harry Winks, Dele Alli, will these players be at the club? Because they will get one chance, as they did with Mourinho. They get one chance with Conte, and they either sink or swim.
John, just before we let you go, there was an update, or at least reports of an update, on Unai Emery overnight.
Yeah, Gillian Beleg was writing that. I don't believe it's going to happen. We don't know the reasons exactly for that, but Unai Emery, I suppose the one factual thing is that Unai Emery has confirmed that there has been interest from Newcastle in him. Villarreal won last night to beat Young Boys 2-0. And then there's reports that it might not happen. I don't know whether it's going to happen or not. What all these things, unless it actually is there, and you know, you get the feeling that he's going to actually go to Newcastle, then you can't really believe one way or the other. But I suppose it's interesting that he has been contacted by the club and has been sounded out. But whether he wants to go yet, I don't know. I don't think it's going to happen. From what you believe in some of the reports, it seems like it's more unlikely than likely now.
John Duggan, good stuff this morning.
All right, folks, take care.
Cheers. Make sure to check out those virtual insanity tips on otbsports.com as well. It's interesting, that Emery story, because it seems to be reported as almost a done deal on a lot of the newspapers actually this morning, whereas, as John says, Guillaume Balague says that Emery sounded reticent about his future just after the game, as he didn't know the latest. Then he was told about leaks, pressure, and after originally being very interested in and hearing more, he decided to stop it all. His family, friends and players told him to stay. The club insisted he is building a squad to his image and everyone has respect. A not so good start in La Liga changes nothing. At the end, we all went to be where we are loved and respected. So this is not considered a negotiation ploy. Unai remains at Villarreal in a project he is hugely enjoying. So that is a very interesting development, as I say, Guillaume Balague reporting that this morning. And if these reports are true, then Emery stays.
And it seems well thought out from Unai Emery as well, Kenny, because like one of the lines that Guillaume Balague has is, what does Eddie Howe have to do with Unai Emery, for instance? So it seemed to be either Eddie Howe or either Unai Emery, and that for Unai Emery suggested that there was no clear vision of actually what they wanted from a manager. Two very different styles of play, two very different ways about going about the business, that basically Newcastle are just trying their luck here. Like, they're not quite sure still in this new ownership what they want.
You know, I can understand the Unai Emery link. because I think it's about the short term at the moment for Newcastle United this season and making sure they're still in the Premiership next year. They won't be able to spend until the window in January, so it's a case of bringing somebody in. For me, you got to bring somebody in, you got to bring a good coach in who can coach that team and get more out of the group than they've been getting previously. And I'm a big fan of Emery in terms of how he sets his teams up. Even prior to him going back to Villarreal, I think the certain managers, when you watch the team playing after about 10-15 minutes, you can see as clear as day in terms of the work that's been done with them on the training pitch. In particular, I'd say the defensive setup that he has, I think, is fantastic. Now, obviously, he had his fingers burnt a little bit at Arsenal, but I think he's a top class coach. And I think from Newcastle's point of view, if you're thinking, look, that elite manager which we want, he's not available at the moment, but we need to bring in an experienced manager who's a very good coach who can really get the best out of this group in the short term, I think someone like Unai Emery would be top of my list. I don't think necessarily that works for Unai Emery. He must be thinking, have they really got confidence bringing me in? Do they really think I'm the one who can bring the club to the promised land, or am I just literally keeping this seat warm?
Well, it does feel like that is what the next 5 years needs to be. You need to, because you can't underestimate how much trouble Newcastle are in right now. That squad, unless Callum Wilson can start scoring goals and scoring a lot of goals, that squad are in massive trouble at the moment. We don't know what sort of players going to want to go there, except for the money in January. So you need someone to survive.
Yeah.
Then you probably go for your Roberto Martinez type, who'll bring you an attractive style of football, and you bring in more quality players. And then you probably need one of the best in the world to bring you into that Champions League level.
Yeah, I don't know, to be honest with you. I think I'm a big fan of Martinez, to be honest with you. Just timing, really. I just don't see him jumping at the moment from that position at Belgium. That's the problem with a lot of these elite, top-class managers that they're perceived to be that, just in terms of availability. Conte was one of them who wasn't available. That hasn't happened, obviously. He's jumped to Tottenham. So in the circumstance, if they feel as if they can extricate Emery from his contract without too much aggravation, I wouldn't agree with you in terms of Newcastle. Like, they're in desperate trouble. I think they're certainly concerned in the position they're in, but I think the squad's good enough.
Really?
As it is. Yeah, I think the squad, well, it has been, the squad's kept them up for the past couple of seasons, so I think the squad is good enough. I think there's a good coach to get a little bit more out of them, and with a bit of reasonable investment, I don't even think significant investment in the transfer window, two or three players, the right players,
midfielders,
possibly. I think they've got a good, in terms of Callum Wilson, you mentioned about operating high up the pitch, yeah, absolutely, if they can keep him fit. But the likes of Almiron, Sam Maxine, I think is a match winner as well, so I don't think they're lightweight in terms of across the top end of the pitch. And you might say to me, well, I haven't got like world class defenders. No, but that's where that kind of coaching ethic comes in. A good manager, a good coach who can set the team up well defensively. You know, it's all about the collective. It's not about the individual qualities necessarily of defenders. It's
just not convinced by Javier Manquillo and Matt Ritchie being your fullbacks.
Yeah, you know, but that's what I'm talking about. A good coach is all about the whole being better than some of the individual parts, as we said. So that's why I think it's important they don't bring in somebody who's a good talker, comes into the dressing room, people think, oh, he's a great talker, oh, amazing personality, this manager. And he rolls onto the training pitch, the lads are like, oh, what's that, we're playing five-a-sides here every day, but that's not good enough. We need a bit of structure here to what we're doing. So that's why I kind of understand the Emery approach. I'm not too sure whether it's going to happen, to be honest with you, but I can understand that. I think it'd be a good choice if they were to get him in, but possibly only in the short term in relation to what they, you know, that elite manager that we're talking about potentially to come in at some point down the road.
All right, it is coming up to a minute to nine on this Wednesday morning. OTBAM is with you with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. We've got plenty of reaction to what we were chatting about earlier on. John says, Duff was an incredible player for the Republic of Ireland, very underrated. We could do with him now. And then loads on Manchester United, as you can imagine. Aidan says, morning lads, hope you keep me entertained for my trip from Mallow to Athlone. Ole is at the wheel, more like Ronaldo at the wheel. Patrick says, Manchester United are in the deja vu business, the entertainment business, scoring in the last minute business. But one thing they are not going to be with this substitute teacher is the winning trophies business. Bido says, United are a circus act. DP says, Pogba is too inconsistent. You don't quite know what you're going to get with him. Stuart says, Ole is so much out of his depth. If he loves United, he should own up and resign. The club should be all that matters. His pressers are awful and embarrassing. And then Mark makes a prediction for the weekend. City will put four past them, he reckons. What do you think?
Not too sure. I give United a real fighting chance at the weekend.
United have had City's number for the last couple
of years. Yeah, I think you're right. psychologically, like, yeah, there's a lot of positive there from United's point of view, and I still think they can hurt. Man, you never know Guardiola in terms of that team he's going to put out, and if he kind of, if he weakens them a little bit, Guardiola, and weakens, I'm talking about, you know, I guess it doesn't get quite the balance between that kind of defensive structure we're talking about with United. But he did it in the Champions League final last year, Guardiola, he weakened them defensively by playing Gundogan in that holding midfield position. I think it cost him on the day, probably cost him the trophy. So if he opens the door a little bit for Manchester United, we know the qualities Manchester United have up the pitch. You know, I give Manchester United a real kind of fighting chance. Laporte's out of the team, actually, probably not a bad thing, to be honest with you. I was surprised he's still in the team. I'm surprised Stones hasn't,
right.
Yeah, hasn't come in. Yeah, Laporte's looked a little bit shaky, so may not be a bad thing from Manchester City's point of view. He's out, maybe Stones is in a replacement, but still think City give you opportunity, particularly counter attack. We're talking about United's low defensive block, dropping back in, inviting teams onto them. With City, he'll come on strong. Always get those opportunities to punch through Manchester City.
Saw the goals the Palace scored at the weekend, and I was over at the Burnley game, and you know, game you probably don't take much notice of. They win 2-0, but Burnley got them on the counter attack on three or four occasions. Just didn't have that bit of quality. And it's all still a little bit slow for Manchester City. It's nice, yeah, but it feels very pedestrian at the moment.
Yeah, when they slow it down, it's a little bit too slow. It's a little bit more sideways and possession for possession's sake. For me, like, they're not as effective. But you mentioned about the counter-attack. So everybody would think, yeah, absolutely, this is the way forward. So if United are going to play, say, for example, Nathan, with the front two that they did at Spurs, is that the best front two, you think, to operate a low defensive block and to break out and to literally outrace the likes of John Stones and Ruben Diaz? Is Cavani and Ronaldo the two strikers that you want? They're going to outpace
Greenwood
teams.
Could you play Greenwood and Ronaldo?
Yeah, well, this is the thing. I think if you were arguing for this particular game against Manchester City to play this type of low defensive block and to break out from that and punch and pick City off and to get those centre-halves and 1v1 situations down the sides, for me, there's an argument for you play Rashford and Greenwood as your front. You don't play Ronaldo or Cavani.
Nice.
If you're playing with front two for this specific game and you're going to drop off them and encourage them onto you, this is the interesting kind of conversation around. We've been having it all morning, like, so these are the big decisions he's going to have to make. We know he's not going to make that one, don't get me wrong, Ronaldo's going to play,
yeah,
but there might be an argument there for the likes of Rashford or Greenwood coming in alongside him, just a little bit more of an injection of pace and dynamism on the counter attack with that person maybe who plays alongside Ronaldo.
All right, it'll be very interesting. And wasn't it Martial who killed him last season as well? I'm not suggesting he'll come into the team at all, but it could well be a team sheet that we don't expect once again with Solskjaer this weekend. So that is the half 12 game on Saturday. City, of course, in action tonight. They play Club Brugge at 8 o'clock. The other game in that group is RB Leipzig against Paris Saint-Germain. That game is on in Leipzig. Just to run through some of the other results from last night in case you missed them. The other game in Manchester United's group was Villarreal beating Young Boys 2-0 at home. Chelsea weren't great. They won 1-0 away to Malmo, but they're in great position now. Juventus are true. They beat Zenit 4-2 in that group. Bayern Munich also true. They hammered Benfica 5-2. And the other game in that group, which was, again, a very nervy game for anybody involved with Barcelona, they won 1-0 away to Dinamo Kiev. So they leapfrogged them. They're in good position now to qualify. And then the other group last night, one of the hipster groups, Lille won 2-1 in Sevilla. And then Wolfsburg beat Salzburg 2-1 at home to kind of open up the qualification prospects in that group. Tonight then, elsewhere outside of Man City's group, you've got Real Madrid against Shakhtar at 5:45, and then the other game in that one is Inter going to Sheriff. Sheriff knowing that if they draw that one, they maintain a really surprising but great position to qualify. Dortmund take on Ajax, looking for revenge for the hammering they took in Amsterdam last time. And then Sporting go up against Besiktas in that group. Milan against Porto is the other early game at 5:45, and that is, of course, in Liverpool's group. It is Liverpool against Atletico Madrid tonight at 8 o'clock. What are the prospects for this one in terms of fitness, in terms of the team sheet, Nathan? It's been one of these few weeks where you kind of don't really know what sort of midfield Liverpool are going to line up with.
Yeah, they just had this constant string of niggly injuries that are ruling players out for two or three games. And like, Thiago's back in training. Fabinho is back in training because of the injury crisis, with Milner out and with Keita out. Jones just coming back to fitness. Do you throw them in, or do you realise Liverpool are in a decent position in this group and maybe you bring one of them in and you just try and get through this game. I can't wait for it, considering how good the game was a fortnight ago. I know there's a lot of questions of, look at how Liverpool collapsed last season because of the defensive problems, and have they left themselves short in midfield because Gini Wijnaldum isn't there. I don't think it's quite that extreme.
Yeah,
just yet. Like they were very, very good for the first half an hour, 35 minutes against Brighton at the weekend. I know they gave away a couple of chances, but they should have been 3 or 4 nil up. That game should have been dead. It seemed to be an attitude problem, which is what Klopp was suggesting after the game, that the heads just went. Oxlade-Chamberlain is definitely an issue, and it was interesting, the quotes after the game. He really seemed to be having a pop at Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, that, you know, he's getting these opportunities. He's probably only getting them because there's 3-4 players injured and he's not taking them. Like, it was a stunning ball for the Mane one, but when the game was getting away from Liverpool, he couldn't get a grip of the ball at all, couldn't slow it down. So it'll be fascinating to see what midfield three he goes with tonight. The niggly injury seemed to be a problem for quite a lot of clubs. Is it the amount of matches they're playing? How big a risk is it throwing Thiago and Fabinho back in again when you've got...
I think Fabinho's the one for me, in terms of giving that... We talk about kind of midfield balance kind of a lot of the morning, haven't we? But think of those players that you've mentioned who could potentially come in. I think Fabinho, because the type of game that he plays, Fabinho, you feel as if he can almost play within himself. You know, he doesn't have to exert himself too much in that holding midfield position, yeah, which predominantly plays for Liverpool. You can kind of play that position, playing about 70-75% of your capacity, and that'll allow him to push Henderson a little bit further forward. And then you're really talking about, as we generally are for me, with that Liverpool midfield three, who's the third one to best complement them. Curtis Jones is fit at the moment, he's played. You know, I'm a big fan of Curtis Jones. Thiago will come into that equation, a different type of player. Again, fitness might be an issue with him. Jones has already got minutes under his belt, so you would think potentially might lean towards Curtis Jones, and that'd be I'd be happy with that midfield three of Henderson, Fabinho and Curtis Jones. Still think there's a little bit there for me. I was watching you mentioned about the Brighton game, Nathan, played some good stuff there, Brian. I saw the highlights of the game. They can play Brighton, don't get me wrong. You're talking about managers, like potentially managers. Graham Potter could be one of them in the near future, could come into the reckoning. But I was looking at a couple of the two goals that they scored. Again, I'm looking at Virgil van Dijk, his movement. We're talking about Harry Maguire in terms of like lumpy, a little bit not the most athletic, not the most dynamic. That's just a fact. That's DNA with Harry Maguire. Virgil van Dijk, we know, is the exact opposite. He's an absolute supreme athlete. It's why he is probably considered, certainly a year or so ago, the best centre-half in the world. But he's still searching. If you notice his movement, the balls around him, even those goals, he wasn't necessarily directly involved, but just planting his feet and moving and accelerating, just get a sense of a player still searching, and might be for some time in terms of his optimum levels.
Is there a chance it doesn't come back?
Well, that would be the worst. That would be the worst case scenario. I mean, you'd hope, you know, the advances in, you know, surgery now, you know, that operation now is pretty much a given in terms of getting people back reasonably close, if not to the level they were before. But it is a very serious operation. It's a very serious injury. And certainly at the moment, he's not where Liverpool need him to be. It's only a small thing. And like I said, you couldn't hang too many goals. Liverpool have conceded this year and say, oh, Van Dijk, he's got done there 1v1, no pace or whatever. But if you look at him in terms of how he's moving over the ground, he's not there. And whether it's a combination, which generally is with these injuries, physical and psychological as well, he needs to kind of push through that. But he needs to kind of push through it quite quickly, because this like league title, it's really on this year, and Chelsea in particular. I'm talking not just about neighbours Manchester City, like a two horse race. Those two have got to be very careful, the results of the weekend, that Chelsea don't suddenly find themselves 6-7 points clear at the top, because they're good enough to actually stay out in front and stay away from those two. So that's what I'm saying, only small little issues there around Liverpool, not a lot. Playing well, there's a lot of good around the team at the moment. I understand that, particularly up the pitch. You get blinded about what's happening higher up the pitch, and particularly what Salah is doing, but it still matters. We've been talking about all this morning, Manchester United, about that balance, the yin and the yang defensive structure, and Liverpool's generally has been very good, don't get me wrong. But just at the moment, little niggles you're talking about, a couple of little individual stuff, and Van Dijk in particular, who's the heartbeat of the team at centre-half, needs to find his A-game, ideally sooner rather than later.
Is there anything you can do to try and offset the impact of him getting back to his best as a manager, I mean? So that you kind of got to expect that Van Dijk looks after himself. If you're Jurgen Klopp, there's not much you can do to control it. But with your team selection, with the midfielders that you pick, with the other defenders that you pick, with the way you set up, is there a way that you can try and temper how much of an impact maybe Van Dijk's struggle to return to form actually has in the team?
Yeah, I think so. And it's the same argument we're making with Manchester United. And so if you have certain limitations, now Van Dijk isn't limited, we know that generally speaking, but he is at the moment because he's searching a little bit in terms of his fitness. So for me, it's only small little things. It's about the like of getting your best holding midfielder in front. Fabinho actually does a job, we know that. But even the likes of Andy Robertson, for me, if I was a left back in Andy Robertson's shoes, I'm looking over at Virgil van Dijk and I know he's not there yet. He's 70-80% where he needs to be. That, you know, that drop dead acceleration, it's not there. So maybe I just have to temper things a little bit, just get narrow up a little bit, give him a little bit more cover. It might be the team itself taking itself 5-10 yards down the pitch. I know this is the last thing you can say to Jurgen Klopp, his head explodes, like the whole team taking itself 10 yards further down the pitch. But these are the small modifications I think which you need to make until you get to a point. Van Dijk's bang, I'm back now, let's go, let's push 10 yards higher up the push.
Is that not what they did last season, Kenny? Is that not the, in a way, a problem for Liverpool? It's what makes them so brilliant when they're at their best, that everything needs to work for it all, for any of it to work. And that last season, when they were missing all the centre backs, suddenly Alexander-Arnold and Robertson had to play a lot deeper because they couldn't trust that their centre backs would be there. And then the high presses, and Salah's having to come back deeper so he can press high.
Yeah.
That it all collapses quite quickly if suddenly you start going 10 yards further back.
I think you're right. That was a problem last night because he hadn't got the players on the pitch, enough of those players to play the type of game Liverpool have been so successful with. And Klopp, from what I was hearing last year, was just reluctant to make those changes. This is us, this is our DNA, this is how we press, we keep that high line, even though we've got an 18-19 year old playing at centre half. We've got a central midfield there, and Fabinho, excellent midfielder as he is, but not particularly quick on the turn. We're still going to play the same. I'm still at times going to send me full backs higher up the pitch. So for me, that, as much as losing individual players last season was absolutely a massive blow for them, yet the team not being able to function in that way because of that was massive as well. He didn't make those modifications last year, really. We are Liverpool, this is how we play, we'll continue to play this way. So there's a load of stuff going on there. I wouldn't kind of dissect that, but at the moment I just think with Liverpool, just small little areas there, just little small areas improvement that they need to tap into. And Van Dijk's one of them, and I hope he does get back. We know how good a player he is. It'd be a shame, you know, if going forward he was to be reduced a little bit, his physical output type thing and his mobility, his athleticism was to be restricted by that injury. But it can happen. I just hope it's not the case and he can kind of push through and get back to the level he was at.
On that midfield point, and you make the point, Nathan, about Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain maybe struggling, is it a situation where Liverpool have loads of players that can play in that advanced midfield role, where the non-Henderson or Fabinho role, that they've got a heap of players who can play there, that if the Ox was beside Henderson and Fabinho at the weekend, maybe his deficiencies wouldn't have been as laid bare, that essentially the longer the season goes on, the more they're missing someone like Gini Wijnaldum, who can play more of the three positions effectively?
Possibly. I still think when you take Henderson out of that sort of right side of midfield role, that he is a massive loss. He was playing deeper at the weekend, and while he can comfortably cover that spot, I just think the energy he brings in that, again, a little change and quite a few things seem to fall apart for Liverpool. Kenny's a big fan of Curtis Jones. I do wonder, you know, we're talking about Manchester United and their lack of a central midfielder. Do you think Klopp looked at that midfield role with Wijnaldum leaving and thinking, I don't need to sign anyone here because Curtis Jones is ready to step up? Or do you think actually if he had as much money as he wanted to spend and FSG were willing to spend, that he would have gone and bought a 40, 50 million pound midfielder?
Yeah, I think he probably thought he had enough, not just in Curtis Jones. I still don't think Curtis Jones is there, but I'd like to see him get enough game time. I think he potentially could develop into that third central midfielder that we're talking about. I agree with you in terms of Henderson playing as that right side at eight, a little bit higher up the pitch. I think he's fine in that position. But yeah, I think he probably thought, obviously, the limited amount of money to spend, he would have earmarked at centre half, reinforcing their 36 million they spent on Konate. Is that where I want to spend my money? Or do I feel as if I've got enough covering that central midfield area? And the numbers are fine, I think. Despite Ronaldo going out the door, the numbers are fine. Thiago, Oxlade-Chamberlain, Keita. There's another three parked on the bench if Curtis Jones players, and then like you and Harvey Elliott as well, unfortunately out injured as well. So I think they got real options. I suppose the question is there that top quality towards central midfield play? You can have a load of numbers, sometimes you get blinded about, we've got a load of numbers there, we've got plenty of numbers, but really in terms of the actual individual quality of those players, and Noel makes a good point in terms of how you play, the DNA, all very good players, those players, but how do they fit into that Liverpool DNA, high press, high energy, who's the most suited to that? Cater for me took a step back the game against Atletico, the goals they conceded over there, got caught out twice, made some poor decisions in terms of like getting wrong side of people and getting done. That was a concern, because you have to have a like defensive mindset, you got to understand the game, like have a defensive mentality. I know those two number eight positions, there's a notion they get forward and contribute. Henderson does that, scored again last weekend. Kate has actually done it when he's been in the team, he's got two great goals, isn't he? But there's also, you can't carry those players,
yeah.
You can't carry those number two eights when you haven't got the ball. They need a certain game understanding in terms of what's required of them. When Aldam had that, was a beautiful player, could operate anywhere in those midfield three, as you've suggested. Henderson has that defensive mindset in that right side at A position. Keita, that'd be a little bit of a worry of late. Has Curtis Jones got that? I think he's getting it. I think it's getting better. I don't think Thiago has it. That's why I'm very reluctant to see him in the team for that reason, as good as he is technically and as good a footballer as he is. So they're the kind of things which he'll kind of wrestle with going forward, Klopp.
Yeah, so that's going to be one to keep an eye on tonight. It is Liverpool versus Atletico Madrid at 8 o'clock. And will Diego Simeone and Jurgen Klopp shake hands at the end? The answer is no, by the way. They've already established that. So that is the big story already boxed off this week.
Does he have to run past Klopp to get to the, down the tunnel, though? That's the thing. Can he dodge him? Can he dodge him?
So we'll keep an eye on that one later on. It is at 9:16 on this Wednesday morning. And just to mention as well, Liverpool fans won't want to miss our latest Cadbury FC roadshow. We're going behind the scenes at Anfield with legendary striker Robbie Fowler, and we'll also be joined by Liverpool captain and Ireland international Niamh Fahey and former Liverpool midfielder and physio Richie Partridge. It's all with thanks to Cadbury FC and their club partnerships, granting you behind the scenes access at the Premier League's biggest clubs, coming soon to ODB Sports social channels. Now, here's what we've got coming up on OTB Sports Radio today. From 1 o'clock, we've got an OTB Gold interview with Chris Waddle. The Coy Gig Pod is being aired from 3 o'clock. It's a Sporting Mindset retro panel at 4 o'clock. And then OTB Gold is a piece with Paul McGrath from 6, off the ball, live as ever, from 7 o'clock this evening. Right, up next this morning on OTB AM, we're chatting the Republic of Ireland.
OTB AM.
You're welcome back. It is 9:18 on this Wednesday morning. You're with us here on OTB AM, which is with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. Right, so for the last 10-15 minutes this morning in Kenny Cunningham's company, we are doing a defensive masterclass. So we're turning to Nathan to pick the depth chart of the Republic of Ireland. Squad is being announced tomorrow. Tomorrow week, of course, is the Portugal game. These international breaks really creep up on us. But what we're going to do this morning, Nathan, is go through the different positions in Ireland's defence and deliver your depth chart.
Right.
You ready for this?
I've been hung out to dry here because Kenny Cunningham is already, his eyes are piercing through me here.
Yeah, he's usually got his pulse, Nathan, in terms of what the Irish football.
Well, listen, I'm more going with what I think Stephen Kenny is thinking.
Oh, you're trying
right
to get inside
now.
Stephen Kenny's mind. Interesting.
So if everyone's fit, and at the moment there's not too many injury problems, the squad's being announced tomorrow afternoon. Obviously, Daro Shea is still out, but everyone fit, I think he will go back to the defence that ended the game and played so well, by and large, in Portugal, with Coleman, Omobamadele, Duffy, Egan and Doherty at left wing back. I think if Seamus Coleman isn't fit, Matt Doherty is second choice right wing back. And then if both of them are out, Cyrus Christie is probably in there. The left wing back position is one of the more interesting ones in that I think Doherty is now probably first choice. And maybe James McLean has moved ahead of Enda Stevens. Enda Stevens probably been the big loser of the last year. He's had all sorts of injury problems. We've gone from a position where when Stephen Kenny took over, there was so much change happening that Enda Stevens was probably the first name of the team sheet. He was the one guy you thought, left back, left wing back, Enda Stevens is going to play. But he played against Qatar. I thought he was okay. I'm not sure how much we're reading into that. But has barely played in the last 6 months, has got back in at Sheffield United, is fully fit. And it'll be interesting to see how much stock Stephen Kenny puts in what Enda Stevens has done before, and what he's done over the past month, and does he still see him as a better option? Because I thought Doherty at left wing back was exceptional that night, and I'd be surprised if he doesn't start the next night. And McLean is in probably the best form he's been in a number of years. At club level, he's scoring goals, and seems to fit that left wing back position perfectly for what Stephen Kenny wants. So I think it's Coleman, Doherty, Christie, on the right hand side, and then probably Doherty, McLean, Stevens at the moment on the left hand side.
I agree, I couldn't argue too much what you've said there. All I will say with Enda Stevens, which I think is good to have him in the squad, I think he's more than capable, Enda, fitting in and playing the left side of a three at that back three. I think actually that's a position he might actually play more of when he gets a little a bit older, because I think he's a very competent defender, Enda. And I think having somebody playing at that back three who's very good defender you can trust, but also very comfortable ball and travelling out and into midfield and looking to and be progressive with their passing, I think it's a big asset. So in terms of the left wing back position, I'd agree with you. I think people have overtaken him. That's what happens in international football when you're out. But for me, Enda, potentially going forward, there'll be a stronger argument for maybe his inclusion playing left side of a three than there potentially will be as a left wing back.
You'd have Doherty ahead of McLean?
Yeah, I'd put Matt in ahead. It's a tough call. I think James has done really well the past couple of games. I'd probably just lean towards, probably looking back to that Portugal game really, where fellas, if the balance of that back five was really good, Seamus and Matt operating on both sides. So, and Matt's played well as well for Ireland of late. I'd say half his performance has been a high standard as well. So that'd be a tough call. If Seamus plays right wing back like Nathan is suggesting.
Well, that night in Portugal was maybe Seamus Coleman's best performance in an Ireland jersey, certainly in recent years. It still feels like a massive mistake that they moved him back to centre back for the game against Portugal. I know
Azerbaijan,
against Azerbaijan,
I don't think it was a mistake, Nathan, in terms of the fact that he can't play. I'd make the similar argument Seamus playing right at the three as I would end the playing left, which I think he's more than capable. He gives you those footballing qualities to actually play out, which Stephen is looking for. But I think you're right in terms of just upsetting the balance then, in terms of Matt flipping over to the other side and then bringing James in. You had to make another two adjustments there to make that change. So probably all in all,
where actually it turns out that Omar Bamadele would have been perfectly fine to start that game.
Yeah.
We're well stocked defensively at the moment. Stephen Kenny said it when he took over the job, that, and I think at that stage he was probably looking at a Coleman, Duffy, Egan, Stevens back four. I think he said if they're all fit, it's probably a top 10 international teams in Europe back four. Omar Bamadele is emerging, like the young defenders that we have. Omar Bamadele is still only 19.
Nathan Collins as well.
Nathan Collins, who I mentioned was over at the Manchester City game. He started for Burnley that day and was exceptional. Now, it's strange playing against City because they don't have a striker at the moment. Made a couple of mistakes in the last couple of minutes. Maybe the concentration levels went. But this lad is a unit. Mm-hmm. 6'4", built like a tank. And already you're looking at him thinking, he is going to be pushing for John Egan or Shane Duffy. Or maybe, and this is the other conundrum for Stephen Kenny, Omar Bamadele started for Norwich at the weekend. Daryl Shea is injured at the moment. Like maybe Collins, if Tarkowski goes to Newcastle in January, we know the way Sean Dyche works. When you're in, you're in. If Nathan Collins gets in January, he's probably going to be in for the next few years if he performs to a level that suddenly he's the one who's playing first team football every week and he's the one who's going to be starting for Ireland.
Yeah. No, it's great to see. That's the only problem with him at Burnley in particular, but that combination of Tarkowski and me, very rarely injured. Both of them, he sticks with them like week in week. A problem Kevin Long's had there really for quite a considerable period of time. So that's something Nathan's going to have to look at going forward in terms of game time. Because, the little bit that I've seen him play, the qualities that you've mentioned, and actually it's those other qualities, just so big but so comfortable on the ball. We got a bit of a flavour against Qatar. He came on for like 20 minutes, but just ball at his feet, simple, just punching it out to the right and left and travelling with the ball, looked very comfortable. He's very similar to, I mentioned it once, I played with his old man actually, schoolboy football in Dublin, David Collins, who was a lovely player, very similar. Dave was powerful for his age, physically very powerful, but a lovely footballer. He went to Liverpool when he was very young, Dave, and he had a career. So obviously it's been a help having Dave in his ear the past couple of years in terms of his development. But yeah, that's great to see, and I think you're right across that kind of defensive structure now. Omar Bamadele and Nathan Collins in particular really pushing strong at the moment, those players in there. So yeah, it's good to see.
So assuming everybody is fit, which may not be the case, but everybody in the centre of defence, you're still going Omar Bamadele, Duffy, Egan and O'Shea first man up?
Well, O'Shea is injured at the moment, but I think as we're looking, as we probably need to start, once Portugal is done, start looking towards the next qualification campaign. Like, Duffy and Egan aren't going anywhere, they're still going to be in the squad, but O'Shea looked as though he was going to be the main man until he picked up that injury. Omar Bamadele has probably gone in front of him. You hope O'Shea comes back and continues his potential, gets back into the Premier League. But I think it's going to be fascinating to see when Collins and O'Shea start to make that breakthrough. Obviously, Shane Duffy's back in top form again, so it's not going to happen anytime soon. Maybe John Egan, if doesn't get a move or if things don't work out with Sheffield United, is quickly looking over his shoulder, which is what you want, as you say, at international level. You need these options. After that, then, you're waiting for the next generation probably to make the breakthrough, because at the moment, he'll go with a Kevin Long in the squad, but Kevin Long has spent season after season, as you mentioned, on the bench at Burnley, gets minutes here. Daryl Lenihan plays all the time. Yeah. It sort of feel like he could be one of those now traditional Republic of Ireland late developers at 27, 28.
He's been a bit unlucky, Daryl Lennon, because any time he's come in, he's had a couple of games, he's some minutes on the pitch. I think he's done absolutely fine, to be honest with you. I couldn't mark him down. He's looked kind of comfortable, kept things simple, which is what you want to do really as a centre-half for me, club and international football. You've got to be able to trust your defenders, do the simple things, do the right things, be good decision-makers. He hasn't had a huge amount of time. I think he's actually been a little bit unlucky, Daryl Lennon, that he's found himself out of the squad, but that's only a reflection of the level of competition that we have in that area of the pitch now, which is great.
Yeah, and then you're into a Jimmy Dunn, who's not quite getting his game time yet at Queen's Park Rangers, moved to Queen's Park Rangers, but hasn't managed to fully break into the team yet. And Ciarán Clarke is the sort of wild card in that he hasn't retired from international football. He's playing sort of every second game for Newcastle at the moment in the Premier League. I sort of felt he was on the verge of something big with Ireland, and then that night against Serbia, probably at fault for a couple of the goals, and I wonder, has that tarnished him in Stephen Kenny's mind?
I don't know, it's just one of those things. I think, Nathan, you're out for a period of time. This is international football, it's elite football. People come in and grab their take their opportunity, and then you're behind the curveball a little bit. It's not easy to fight your way back in. That's the way it should be, to be honest with you. So I don't think the players you're mentioning there, I don't think it's a reflection. I don't necessarily think you have to look for that one bad game or a massive drop off or something fundamentally is wrong here with his game. It's just the fact he's down the pecking order at the moment for whatever reason. Usually injury is generally is generally the reason. He's making about end of Stevens, probably the best example of that. You just got to fight your way back. You got to keep banging on the door and work your way back in. That's the way it should be.
Ciarán Clarke is in a relatively similar situation to Darren Randolph, it seems, that the guys in front of him are too good and too young to think that there will be a meaningful opportunity for him at any point over the next couple of years.
I think Clarke has more reason to be frustrated, though, because Clarke is playing for Newcastle, whereas Randolph is third choice. He's not even making the bench for West Ham, and that's a decision he's obviously had to make. Whereas I think Clarke is, it's a tough time at Newcastle at the moment for anybody, and maybe not helping things. I think he would feel he's definitely good enough to be in that squad ahead of some of the other players. But you're right, Omar Bamidele has done nothing wrong. Nathan Collins is such a talent. You want him in there learning as much as he can. And maybe Stephen Kenny looks at it and thinks, if Ciarán Clarke's not going to be playing, is there a real benefit to him being in and around? He knows it. He knows if he needs him, he can slot back in quite easily. So, yeah, as I say, I think we're incredibly well stocked. If you go below that, someone like Mark McGuinness, who's with the 21s, who's been with McCarthy in Cardiff, who's getting his game and has been getting his game over the next while, is probably one who might be in that next generation. But again, you are then reliant on English football and who gets the chance and who gets the game.
Exactly, yeah.
What are you looking to see in particular next week, Kenny? Are you gonna, what sort of expectations will you be rocking up to Lansdowne Road?
Is Nathan gonna drift into central midfield and start naming your players there and up front?
That's next week.
Because you've done the easy bit. Oh, you're just concentrating on
the
defensive
talent
line.
We have
a defensive guru in the studio, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think the interesting discussion is forward up the pitch. That kind of the balance, you know, how that kind of midfield and forward areas and how Stephen sees that going forward, but. Now, the defensive side, I think it would be interesting, the Portugal game. I don't think we've really been stress tested too much in these last two games. I think we've played some good football. We've all been excited in terms of the quality of the football which we played, chances created, goals scored in the past couple of games, some little combinations, some little partnerships which are developing around the pitch, and that's all well and good. But I don't think defensively we've really been tested in the last two games. And there's been just a couple of situations, both those games, Azerbaijan and Qatar, when I just feel as if we've been a little bit open. We've opened ourselves up a little bit to kind of counter-attack transitions. Those two teams have got at us occasionally. Probably not good enough in terms to really kind of ram it home. So that's what I'm interested in against Portugal in terms of the team on the pitch. The attacking qualities which we've seen over the past couple of games, but also that real kind of defensive mindset, that defensive structure, which has to be on the same level as well. That has to be the same. You know, we can't be heading up there in terms of the quality of football which we're playing, and then once we turn over possession, all of a sudden we're all over the place, we're open, and teams are playing through us, and the better teams
will open. There were signs, I thought, maybe against Qatar, that they were getting a bit better than that. And geez, to go right back to the start of the conversation and maybe a comparison with Manchester United and them playing three at the back, that like the pace of Iran makes such a difference for United to be able to push high up the pitch, that Ireland quite often, when they lose the ball, and there's probably a bit of maybe naivety in midfield at times, that they all push up and then they lose the ball and there's this huge gap. But against Qatar, definitely you could see Shane Duffy, the second forward, lost the ball. He sort of stepped 10 yards into the opposition half and the other two centre halves were the ones to drop back. So at least there's some pressure, because geez, like, it's been a sort of constant of the last year that when Ireland lose the ball, the defence head for home as quick as they can, and suddenly there's this massive gap opening up. Like, is that how that needs to work, that one of the centre halves applies some pressure?
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily the centre half. So we're talking about Manchester United, the individual qualities of players there, Fred, McTominay, the defensive attributes. I don't think any of them's a natural defender. So if I look at air midfield, say as a comparison, I think, well, who's the natural defender there? Who's got those natural defensive instincts? Who, when you turn over possession of the ball, I'm not talking about necessarily going and pressing straight away, but when you haven't got the ball and they're sat in that central midfield, who understand what's required in terms of cutting off passing lanes into opposition forwards, in terms of when to go and put pressure on the ball, when to drop into space, when to track runners, when to pass them on, sliding, giving good information, sliding people into different areas. So I don't think we have an abundance of them in the squad. I look at Jeff Hendrick, I think he's been great the past couple of games. It's been great to see how well he's played. But Jeff, for me, is someone that you've got to take the breaks off. You've got to let him go and play. He likes to get himself in advanced areas and go and link up with players in forward areas of the pitch. So he actually likes to vacate that central area of the pitch. And you want to encourage him to do that because he's actually good at it. So again, that's putting a lot of pressure on the player then alongside him. Josh Cullen is probably the player for me, probably best suited to that, kind of understands that role, who kind of sit in there in that kind of fulcrum in that central midfield, who kind of sense danger. Now, Josh isn't like Kante in terms of his ability to get quickly over the ground or a physical specimen in terms of dominating that area of the pitch, but I think he understands that role. Conor Hourihan for me is someone, again, a ball playing midfielder, and someone for me who's at his best the closer he gets to the opposition goal. We know the delivery he's got into the box, you know, once he gets 30 yards from the opposition box, particularly wide areas, puts great delivery into the box, kind of good range of passing.
Seems to have fallen slightly down the pecking order.
Yeah, but Conor for me doesn't look like somebody at his very best when he's asked to play like defensive role in that centre. Conor go and make tackles, wrestle the ball off, be a dominant physical presence in that area of the pitch. So
he was great for Swansea when he went there last season. He was playing in that sort of more advanced sort of number 8 kind of.
Yeah, exactly. So that's where I've always seen it. For me, I'm with Jeff and Conor, I'm always in my mind, I'm thinking I'm pushing them higher up the pitch, get closer to the opposition goal, get closer contact with your front two, front three, and go and play in little combinations and whatever. They're good enough to do that. But then it's all about, again, that kind of balance. What are you leaving behind you? Are you leaving yourself a little bit more open to those kind of quick counters and transitions? So, again, that'll be interesting. I think that's the area for me that'll be interesting against Portugal. If we strike that balance right in terms of committing players high up the pitch and offering a threat from an attacking point of view, but also dropping into really solid defensive shape and having players who are very comfortable actually out of position and actually understand their role, particularly in those central midfield areas.
Yeah, well, just 8 days to go until the Portugal game. Have you got your hands on a ticket yet?
No.
Kenny will be there working for a rival organisation, but still coming to us looking for the Wi-Fi password, trying to explain to him what a hashtag is for half an hour before the game.
I'm not begging for tickets for you know, even high profile.
I know.
But events. It's
Portugal, Kenny. You know. Come on. I mean, we'll all be begging.
I'll find my way in there.
Any work? Can I? Like, do you need a runner next week?
Of course.
Yeah, always. Nice one. Brilliant. Yeah. I mean, I've got myself in the order, Kenny. That's how you
carry
do
all my gear. You know.
That's how you do it. Kenny, great stuff. Thanks, many, for popping in this morning, Nathan. Yes. Thank you. It is 9:34, and we've still got a bit more to come for you this morning. This has been OTBAM with Gillette, proud sponsors of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow. So tomorrow morning, Michael Verney is in to co-host alongside Adrian. We'll hear from Gareth Roberts, Fiona Hayes, and much more as well.
OTB AM with Gillette, proud supporters of Movember. Gentlemen, let's mow.